And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. A couple guests for you this hour, and later on we'll open up the phone lines. Dan Aykroyd has enjoyed a three-decades-long career in the entertainment business, including his run as a not-ready-for-primetime player on the celebrated early days of Saturday Night Live, produced 9 screenplays on which he shares co-writing credits. Dan is also a Grammy and Oscar nominee. In his persona as Elwood Blues, he performs on 7 CDs. He's a member of the Association of Canadian Television Radio Artists, the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists, the Screen Actors Guild, the Writers Guild of America, and is a subscribing benefactor to the American Society for the Psychical Research and the Mutual UFO Network. Dan Aykroyd. Dan, it's been 4.5 years since you were on with Art Bell on Coast to Coast. Welcome back.
Well, we have lost the connection with Dan, so we will have to...
There we go.
There you go.
Yeah, there we go. Thank you so much. Sorry about that.
That's okay. My pleasure. Yeah, it's been 4.5 years since you've been on the program.
It's always a pleasure to listen, though, while I am away, driving wherever I am in North America. You know, it's such a joy to have you come across with these intelligent, articulate guests that you have on. I must say, the other night I heard the Stephen Greer interview, and I think he's the real thing, George. I really do.
I do too, Dan. And let's bring in David Sirita as well. Of course, David's been on Coast to Coast numerous times. His first aspiration in life was to become an astronaut in 1968. He and a friend witnessed a UFO along with hundreds of other witnesses. And after this experience, David grew up as a UFO enthusiast, never living in doubt of the phenomena that has swept the world since the Roswell incident in 1947. Now, his interest, of course, is space, religion, philosophy, astronomy and science that led him on his career in related fields. He is here with us on Coast to Coast. David, welcome back to you.
Yeah, happy birthday to you, George.
Thank you. As a matter of fact, Dan, you're going to have yours on July 1st, if I remember, right?
Yes, that's correct. I'm a proud Canada Day baby, correct?
We're all there. Dan, you have been all over the place the last week or so. I've seen you on Fox, CNN, MSNBC. Talking about the DVD, Dan Aykroyd Unplugged on UFOs, what I love about all this is the mainstream media finally starting to take interest in this very serious subject that they never did before.
Well, it's interesting, you know, how I came to do this video with David. I had, of course, been interested since in this phenomenon from, you know, from youth. My mother had an experience when she was... In the early 50s, just before I was born, and she saved the Life magazine cover from the 50s in July. Of course, you'll remember that great sighting over Washington, D.C. in July of 1952, in the latter part of July. That was written up in Life magazine, and she saved that for me. And when I was 9 or 10 years old, I saw that, and I asked her about, you know, flying saucers, are they real? And she really didn't answer me then. It's only recently that she talked about her sighting. And I you know, of course, as any red-blooded North American boy, I loved to watch the movies, The Day the Earth Stood Still, Earth versus the Flying Saucers, and I had my two experiences, which I've spoken about before, but I'd really put it all to bed, you know, and kind of, well, I'd hit a wall. I got past where John Mack had taken the movement, where how do we transform this Earth? If these beings are coming here, how do we use it? How do we positivize it? And I was in Cleveland, Ohio, and we were opening our House of Blues there, and a beautiful location at Euclid and right there in the Flats District.
Sure is.
I've got all kinds of other pursuits in my life, and I was there at the local television station, the affiliate there, and one of the producers said, "Would you do a piece on UFOs for us?" I said, "Really? What? People are interested in that?" He said, "Every time we do a UFO story, the ratings on our station go up, and we beat the other guy hands down." In this area. And I thought, really, the people of Cleveland are that interested. So I did the piece, and then I guess, you know, it was shortly after that David and I started to gel this idea of just bringing people up to date with where the movement is today. So that's really what the video is about. And I always say, take the speed gun and skip through my boring talk and get to some of the incredible footage and interviews that we have.
Well, in an industry in Hollywood where they have done some incredible films on UFOs, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, E.T., not a lot of Hollywood people or celebrity status entertainers, Dan, jump forward to talk about this. You may be the only one to do this. Why is that?
Well, I think there's a lot more immediate causes on the planet and in life that need focus. And I think Angelina Jolie has done a tremendous job of looking at African poverty. You can't fault the work of Bono. People say all these celebrities, they go around in their jets and they, you know, and they get involved in these causes on an ad hoc basis. But wherever you can bring attention and focus to the disparity in the world, that's good. So at the bottom of people's lists is, to me, the greatest mystery of our century, which, as you say, started with Arnold and Roswell back there in the 40s. There are people interested. Of course, Spielberg is interested. He made two of the best movies about the topic. Mel Torme's son, I'm sure you've had him on the show.
Yep.
He made Fire in the Sky. Bob Weiss, who is a producer who just made the Scary Movie project, and he's an XPRIZE committee member. He's my producer on Coneheads. We did that together. He's very interested in this this subject. And so as the Hollywood consultant for MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network, which many of your listeners know about, it's probably the greatest website and magazine dealing with the subject, with a whole database of scientists. As it's my job to get more people interested and also to be available for the screenwriter or the producer that wants to do a movie about Tinley Park, Illinois, where they're seeing big black deltas go over at the speed of a jogger, two football fields long, you know, that kind of story. If someone wants to do that kind of story, then I can access the database here in the magazine, get the interviews, get them with the field investigator that worked on the case, and affect that kind of a union. So Hollywood should be more interested because, you know, after all, it's very entertaining, this subject, and there's money to be made in it.
Well, absolutely, and the video that I see in the DVD is absolutely astounding. You know, David, you hinted about a year ago when you were on with me that something big was coming, and here it is. Why'd you decide to go to Hollywood to make your case for this?
Well, it's like Dan said. I mean, look at the numbers on Close Encounter. In 1977, it grossed $337 million, but when you convert that at the U.S., American Institute for Economic Research, they have this little inflation calculator on their website. It comes in at 1.1 adjusted 2006 dollars, 1.1 billion. And ET, which grossed, you know, nearly 800 million in 82, adjusted comes to 1.6 billion, which is even beyond James Cameron's Titanic. So it shows you the confirmation from Hollywood into the subject is so absolute. I mean, you can look at the CNN Time polls, which vary. I mean, 80% of Americans believe the government's hiding extraterrestrial bodies, and then you get smaller numbers on UFOs, but, you know, 70%. So, you know, when you have these debunkers come on a lot of these shows, they think that, okay, we debunked it, we put it to bed, but the American public doesn't buy it. When they go to the movie and they buy the tickets and they, you know, go to Close Encounters and they see War of the Worlds, they see all these movies, that tells you what they're really interested in. These are the biggest movies ever made. The top dollars are coming in from these movies. And I think people want more of it. And when, you know, Dan and I used to have, when he got interested in my NASA UFO film and did the cameo introduction, he was very, you know, intrigued by the evidence that there are UFOs appearing on space shuttle missions. That was kind of the beginning for him and I. But we would have these conversations over dinner, and I was like, wow, man, if people could only hear what's inside of Dan's mind. I mean, he is the most brilliant person in Hollywood on the subject, and he's one of the most eclectic, most brilliant minds, I think, on the planet. And I just thought, you know, I want to share this conversation and entertain people with the newest, latest footage of UFOs and photographs, and, you know, looking at the B-2 bombers and all our best fighter planes, so you can visually confirm that, okay, that's the B-2, that's the F-117, mm-hmm. and that's the UFO. Sorry, it's not the same thing. So you kind of have to put it in a form. And Dan is really the best person. I mean, and it is history. He's making history in this last week, doing all these shows, promoting the DVD. My friend Andre in New York said people lined up around the block at the FYI store to go meet him and get their DVD. And in Pennsylvania, they had the same kind of turnout. It's almost like, I mean, it's not Star Wars. It's a simple film, but you're looking at real, authentic footage, I believe, of UFOs. You know, and even though some of it's grainy, Well, that's because the Sky Watchers who have these video cameras. It's not 20th Century Fox with a big, you know, lens out there and the best film, you know, searching for UFOs. It's always the guy who has the little video camera. And there's some pretty amazing shots there that you're going to see. And that's why.
Dan, I'm older than you. Not too much older than you, but I'm older than you. And but I've grown up watching some of your incredible films, and you've entertained us for years. And you've made us laugh, and you made us cry on some of them. And it's just been fantastic to be able to watch your growth and career. In this particular case, this was different. And it was interesting for me to see someone who's been such a phenomenal entertainer over the years step into something else that he's very interested in, that is very real, and that potentially could affect all of us. When this was being put together, was there one specific case, one UFO issue that just stood out for you that you even shake your head at and say, this is unbelievable?
Well, the DVD is full of everything that David and I could get the rights to and put in there that we were impressed with over the last, several years of sightings and footage. But honestly, the thing that really grabbed me, apart from my two sightings, the high-altitude sighting and then the one where I was part of a telepathic
right.
message that took place in the mid-'80s, my wife was witness to that, and as I speak of it, it was in the media and radio calls and newspapers the next day. A similar event happened in Gatineau, Quebec, in the early 90s. 800 to 1,000 people reported, being urged to go out on their front porch in the evening to look out on their back porch or their windows or their driveways to look up in the sky and see this sight. It wasn't even those things that grabbed me. What it was one night when Art was still doing the show. Mm-hmm. I was driving across America and listening to Coast, as I know so many drivers are tonight as they make their way across this magnificent checkerboard that we call North America, this Canada and the mm-hmm. U.S., this magnificent country, this beautiful Western world we live in with its freedom and its topography. And, going driving at night is the greatest. And I was driving across, and Art had a show on there about I know you might remember this. I think it was Libertyville, Ohio, or Liberty, Ohio, some township in Ohio, where for 2 hours they had radio transcriptions, transmissions taped of about, I think it was 4 to 6 police officers chasing this UFO for about 2 hours. And it was absolutely gripping to hear the way these guys, and you could replay this show sometime. I mean, it was just gripping the way they had these guys going across in their police cars at 90 miles an hour, following the thing, as it skimmed treetops and towns and went through intersections. And then at the end, one of them climbs up on a water tower. Now, of course, the meteorological explanation was that they were chasing Venus.
How
you race along with the moon sometimes in your car, you look up and it seems like the moon is racing along with the car when you were a little kid. It looked like that. Well, this was the explanation that was given, was that it was Venus racing along beside their police cars. But it sure didn't sound like they were chasing Venus to me. The cops were excited.
Well, and I heard when I was in St. Louis at the time doing one of my local shows, Dan and David, some police officers from Millstadt, Illinois, were chasing and tracking a massive-sized triangular-shaped object. Same thing. People are trying to tell them that they're seeing something else. They weren't. They saw what they saw, and I believe these Ohio police officers saw something that was very unusual.
The triangles are really incredible. You guys have one on your site, on the Coast to Coast site. Some kid was taking a picture. I've got to send this one to you, Dan. And he blows up the photo, and you can see these. It's twilight. I mean, the sun has just gone down. There's that faint, pale blue in the sky, and you can see these clear lights on each corner, and you can see the silhouette of the black. Now, when you look at the B-2 bomber, and I got a close look and got some footage from the Edwards Air Force Base Air Show last summer, the lights and the triangular formation on the F-117 and the B-2 are small, and they're inside of the configuration of the shape. They're not on the points, not on the edges. And so when you look underneath an F-117 and you look at this thing and you go, no, it's not the same thing, and we don't have anything like that in our arsenal of aircraft, so what is it? And like Dan said, I mean, some of these, I know this, another Hollywood actor, not nowhere near as big a star as Dan, but he was in upstate New York, and he was videotaping these huge triangles moving very slowly in upstate New York, and apparently helicopters chasing these things. It's becoming an epidemic, the number of people who are videotaping and having sightings.
All right, it's all over. Hey, David, stay with us. David and Dan will be back in just a moment. We've got to take this break. We're also going to open up the phone lines, give you an opportunity to chat with them as well. David Sirita will stay with us for the rest of the entire program. Dan Aykroyd will be with us for another 20-some minutes. We'll take some phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with Dan Aykroyd, David Sirita. Dan, some of the songs that we play coming in and coming out of the program brings back, of course, memories for you. I wonder how many people realize that you're pretty accomplished as a singer when you were doing this years ago.
Well, it was nice to hear John's youthful voice and us singing on Soul Man there. And, of course, we did the cover of the amazing Spencer Davis Group. Song, Give Me Some Lovin', and last night I performed with Paul Schaefer. He got the Canadian Walk of Fame honor, and I inducted him there along with some other distinguished Canadians, Pam Anderson and Alex Trebek, and we did kind of a drag, the old Buckingham song. I think the more that one does this, if one has the gift of music and can stay with this, like I've been able to do with now the blood brother of Jake, Brother Z, alias K.A. Jim Belushi, you know, if you can keep doing it, you get better, you know, you get better, you practice, you get better at it, and I hope to improve every time I play, which we do for private events. We're available for corporations and casinos really only because of Jimmy's TV schedule. I'd like to play more often, but he's the busy one in the sort of the rigid schedule area of things today, so... We don't play enough. We love to play more, but every time you play, you get better. And every time I play with a great harp player like Kim Wilson or John Popper, you get better, or Charlie Musselwhite, you get better just by being on stage with them.
Oh, sure. And by the way, you've got a standing invitation anytime you're back in Los Angeles to come in here, where I'm here most of the time. So anytime you're here, you just let us know.
Well, I know that's a location in Los Angeles that's a better kept secret than the new F4 near Denver. So
true. Hey, David Sirita, we talk about this DVD, Dan Aykroyd, UFOs Unplugged. Where do you get it?
You can pretty much get it everywhere, I think.
Amazon, FYE, Borders, Target, Best Buy, all your usual spots. Look for my pinched ugly mug. And, David, may I ask you something? The piece you did, you and George, recently on Singularity was absolutely fascinating.
Oh, thanks. You listened to that, huh?
Yeah, somebody needs a week off, George. You could replay that for the listeners. That was gripping. And, again, I was driving through some dark forest in Vermont listening to that, you know. At night.
Well, you know, Dan, David, as you know, has some of the most incredible theories. David, the next hour I want to talk with you about some of those thoughts again about Roswell.
Well, have you run that by Stanton Friedman, the idea that the gamma disturbance blew the two disks into the future? I wonder what Stan would think of that. He could see that as being plausible.
Yeah, he'd say it was a possibility. You know, he's pretty straight when it comes to what he thinks might have happened at Roswell. But that theory that David has is as good as any I've heard.
I've almost finished the book on Singularity, Dan and George. I'm looking for a publisher this summer. I'm just fine-tuning it right now, so it will be... I really got the largest response ever just on that subject. Which, you know, we can talk a little bit later about some of my updates I've made in that field.
All right, let's go to the calls, as
but
promised.
Have you guys heard of Alien Rock? You know, Dan, because you guys were talking about music, the book by Michael Luckman, all the rock stars like Jimi Hendrix, David Bowie,
he asked me to put a quote on the cover of that book, and I just was kind of holding back, David, for our project, and I didn't really want to endorse other things, but I enjoyed the book. I greatly did, and I recommend it now, and I see that he really did some scholarly research on it. But I don't like to endorse every little thing that comes along, you know, because, David, when you and I speak, we know where we're coming from, and we can stand on our bases.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's take some calls. Let's go to our wild card line. Where are you calling from? You're on Coast to Coast.
I'm calling from Toronto, Ontario.
Well, welcome to the show. Go ahead.
Oh, thank you very much. This is a specific question for Dan Aykroyd.
Sure.
I was wondering if we, the people of Earth, ever colonize the Moon or Mars. Will the House of Blues be the first restaurant chain there? Because I think Mr. Aykroyd's got impeccable connections to be the first.
They just might.
It should be in Toronto, actually. That's where it should be.
Hey, that's great. Thanks for the call. Next up, west of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, George. This is Jason in Portland.
Hi, Jason.
1190 KEX.
Sure.
Hi, this question for Mr. Aykroyd.
Sure.
Mr. Aykroyd, you may have realized that for recent times we've been going through this intelligent designer concept. Like if whether God is a scientist, and I think that with all the research that I love that you're doing with the ufology, that God may be a fringe scientist with all perpetual motion concepts. And I'm just wondering what your beliefs are on whether if there is an intelligent designer that he would have all knowledge of these UFOs.
All right, that's fair enough. What do you think, Dan? Intelligent design behind all of this somehow?
Well, I can't. You have to you have to take personalities out of any. Or gender, or any kind of concept of human existence. That when you speak of God, God is in and all around and in all things, linked to everything. And once you tap into that wire, then you can have a very good life and affect change in others, and keep demons away in your own life, however they might come psychologically or otherwise. God is a wide open concept. I say the cosmic engineer. And I think that implies that there's a design. I believe there's a force. I believe it's all not just some random display. I believe there's a force, but it is so mysterious that we shouldn't always try to seek the answers. We should just enjoy the mystery of how God works at the higher levels that make the good things in this multiverse happen. The bad things, I don't know that to God and the Godheads and the Father Earth and Mother Earth and the father figures have anything to do with what happens on this planet. I just think that, you know, UFOs, advanced technologies, all of it, the intelligent designer is behind it all at the beginning, prior to the Big Bang and prior to that and prior to the blackness and antimatter of that. I just don't see it coming from a spark of dust. David, you may disagree.
No, I don't disagree at all. I agree that there is an intelligent designer, and the ultimate reality of God is far beyond the capacity of a human being, and that's what the great mystics experienced when Jesus transfigured on the mountain, when Moses saw God on the mountain. It was too powerful for any human being to even look at unless you were very, you know, qualified spiritually. So, you know, the intelligent designer, I mean, just look at how much energy it would take to make the universe. And if you were to look at the creation source of energy for that entire creation, you wouldn't survive. It's like sending a billion watts of electricity into a one-watt circuit. It would fry it. So we experience as much of it as we can. And religion, I think, today is a very limited, albeit it's what we're capable of perceiving of God so far, but it's not very much.
You know, David, I was talking with Richard C. Hoagland last week about a new piece of equipment, a new satellite that's out there, and they think within the next couple years they'll be able to find out, they'll be able to determine that our universe is floating in another universe. And when you begin to hear things like that, you realize that there's just so much out there that we have misunderstood over the years.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's why I like to use physics to confirm the spiritual and to see, you know, to juggle them back and forth and see how close were the mystics to understanding what 2,005, you know, even 3,000 years ago and compared to what scientists are discovering today. And it's pretty close. And that's what, you know, my book Singularity will get into. But that, you know, that is a constant evolution. We're never going to reach the end of this understanding. It's a really beautiful, fascinating, you know, mystery to even just experience part of it.
Let's go to our first-time caller line. You're on the air with us, and where might you be?
Hi, my name is Leah, and I'm in Playa del Rey.
That's in California, for
hi,
people
George,
who don't
hi,
know.
Dan, hi, Dan and David.
Hello.
Hi. Okay, so I was calling to tell you about an experience I had, which was similar to what Dan was speaking about in the beginning of the show, where you get this feeling, and then you go with it, and then something's there. And I woke up really in the early in the morning to go to a dentist appointment in Venice. And I got there a little early, and there was a few people were showing up, and we were all standing in front of the office because the door hadn't opened up. And I looked up at the moon, and it was the most beautiful morning. It was like the day before Thanksgiving, and it was so clear, and I was looking over the Santa Monica Mountains, and then I looked up, and I noticed the moon was so clear that there was a bright light on the right side of it, and I thought, well, I've never seen a star in the daylight, and I started pointing it out to some of the people that were grouping in front of the dentist's office, and I said, look at that bright dot, and then I thought, what made me, I was thinking of the show that I listened to the night before about sightings, and something told me to be really aware that day. Something told me to really look up and notice something. So then I kind of gave up because it was so tiny, and then this lady said, well, I don't think there's stars that you can see in the daylight. And then I gave up, and we were about to go in the door, and then I looked up one more time, and there were two, and they were right above everybody, right over the telephone wire. And I just happened to have my video camera because I was going to shoot one of my friend's stores like an hour after that. And so I got the footage, and it was – I'm sorry, I'm so nervous. I've never called before.
That's all right, but you've got this. You've got it on video?
Yes, yes, and they were – years, and I didn't see them as well until I zoomed in with my camera.
Oh, my God.
And then when I zoomed in, I noticed that they were, I have them on film, and I tried to send them to you, but they were so, I mean, I guess it was too large to send over the internet, the file.
Well, you got to get that to us, Leah.
But, David will get your number, dear.
Yeah, they were
because
spheres.
You should follow up, you know, there's certain analyses that can be done. Were they gray?
Well, okay, they were oranges, white, like light, and then there was a gray, like something like it looked like a rocket ship thing coming out the bottom of both of them, like a propulsion or some kind of. But they weren't moving, and this man next to me was like, "Well, they're not balloons, and they're not this." And
we're
going
to put you on hold, Leah. I'll tell you what. You give Tom your phone number, and we'll get it to David, and he can follow up with you on that.
Definitely.
Could be remarkable.
I have had
I love getting the new pictures. The one with the stinger, George, this gray look. If it passed you on the highway, you'd think, wow, that's a nice Lamborghini. Really nice.
Exactly.
It looks like a sport model. That some being somewhere has this parked for four to just skip in and out of dimensions. It has a stinger on the back like a manta ray. It was photographed, David, if I'm correct, at three or four different locations within 12 or 14 hours on the planet from different sources, if you believe the website you told me about in England where you got the picture.
Yeah,
I think that guy's reliable.
Yeah, there's different people. You know, these, like I mentioned before, George, these digital cameras that people are taking their pictures, they download the photos. They didn't see the UFO at the time of photography.
Right.
Because they're in these alternate dimensions. But there's two of them that we picked up that look like manta rays, you know, like under the ocean with the big black wings. And they have a stinger tail in the back. And one was in England in a farmer's field, and another one was in Canada.
Vancouver at the dockyards.
Yeah, and I gave Dan those pictures. And
my friend in upstate New York, Billy,
who actually was videotaping these things, he said he saw one of these ones that looked like the manta rays, and he said it didn't look like a metallic craft. They saw it, you know, just before nighttime, and it flew past his car, and it stopped, and it turned around and looked at him. Just stopped on a dime, and the whole thing was like a shark, and then it looked at him, and then it just took off, and it was just flying through our atmosphere. Now, that's pretty spooky.
Hey, you know, we've got Gary McKinnon on Tuesday. He's that British computer hacker.
Yeah.
We've got him on the program the last couple hours of the show. Anything you want us to ask him on behalf of both of you?
Well, I want to ask him this, because he said, Gary McKinnon in the BBC interview, and Dan, I'll forward you this interview on BBC, he said he hacked into NASA's at hangar at NASA where they were retouching photographs of UFOs on space shuttle missions taken with cameras, you know, very good, you know, close range shots of UFOs, and they were retouching them and taking the UFOs out. And what I want to ask him is, you know, this guy is so courageous, Gary McKinnon. He really didn't physically hurt anybody. He didn't physically do a lot of computer damage. He embarrassed the military by getting in their back doors, which is illegal. I mean, I'm not going to support the guy in that department. But I really, this guy is a sacrifice, a sacrificial lamb for the movement. He says that the government has, you know, zero-point energy machines, anti-gravity, technology that could solve the energy crisis of our day, save our planets, save our environment from all the pollution, just based on that technology alone, let alone the fact that there are extraterrestrials visiting us and that he made confirmation at NASA. What I want to ask him is, pretty much everything he discovered in his illegal query, he could have found legally. He could have saw evidence, the case for NASA UFOs, my film.
Yes.
And he could have, Project Disclosure with Stephen Greer. All the information he needed was there. And if in the back door and all these government, websites and computers, he found proof, my question is, was that worth risking a possible 70-year sentence in prison? I mean, I really don't think he deserves that myself, but I'm not the law. I'm not the one who...
Well, you know what they should do? Give him a suspended sentence and just simply cut a deal and say, teach us how you got into our computers.
Yeah, that's what I think. He should be a teacher, but, I think for him, he probably feels very satisfied that there is absolutely confirmation that the government knows. But for me, because I had a sighting very close range in Berkeley in 1968, the confirmation... You know, I can look at all the videotape I want. I saw this thing with my eyes, just like Dan Aykroyd did and many others. David Bowie's, had a sighting. A lot of people have had sightings in Hollywood and have talked about them. In fact, I've been getting calls and emails, Dan, from rock stars and different people in Hollywood that say, hey, I heard your film's coming out with Dan. I want to talk. And I'm not going to name their names just to protect them right now, because I don't have permission to name them, but these are some other very big people, because I think as Dan Aykroyd talks in this film on UFOs, other people are going to come out of the closet in Hollywood, and hopefully this is going to be the beginning of not only Hollywood celebrities and musicians, but hopefully some more politicians will come forward and we'll start to come to a true, complete disclosure.
Well, there's no way that the controlling forces are going to let out anything, any kind of technology, if they have it, for the benefit of mankind at this time.
I agree with that.
This is all going to be held for military superiority. And I don't mind seeing the U.S. Air Force rondelle on any kind of levitation or gravity-defying device without conventional propulsion. I don't mind seeing the U.S. Air Force insignia on one of those machines, frankly. I think David, I'd like to follow up on the Tinley Park in Illinois. We should look into that, because a woman came forward and said that at Halloween there were three kids with metallic red balloons, and that's what people were seeing. They had arrayed them in a triangular way, and they fooled hundreds of kids out on Halloween. But there were other sightings associated with that.
Well, that's one of the reasons Patrick Uskert, remember Dan Pat from Venice, he's also in our film. We did a balloon test for viewers and to show them what a balloon really looks like and the way they kind of float around. They never make sudden stops. They're very drifty. And, once you know what a balloon looks like, and then you look at a real UFO.
Oh, big difference.
Obvious.
Big difference. Hey, we're out of time for the hour, but you, Mr. Aykroyd, again, anytime you want to come here on Coast to Coast, you have a welcome at any moment.
Yes, well, I hope, this is like a Philip Agee case, McKinnon here. Philip Agee was the CIA officer who wrote a book, you'll remember. But this guy's not giving it up for any kind of foreign intelligence. He's giving it to the public, and... I think he'll do all right, and I wish him well.
Very good. Dan, thank you. And Dave Sirita, you stick around, okay?
I will. Good night, Dan.
Good night. Take care.
Thanks.
Take care.
That's
right,
Dan Aykroyd there. And his DVD, of course, is Dan Aykroyd, Unplugged on UFOs. I'm George Norrie. We'll be back now with the full program with our guest, David Sirita, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Let me give you another introduction for David Sirita now. His first aspiration in life, of course, was to become an astronaut, but in 1968, he and a friend witnessed a UFO with hundreds of other witnesses. Kind of changed his life, because after this experience, he grew up as a UFO enthusiast, never living in doubt of the phenomena that has swept the world since the Roswell incident in 1947. His interest in space
religion, philosophy, astronomy, science, led him on his career in related fields. He has studied world religion, science, physics, and paranormal psychology for more than 25 years. He is our special guest tonight on Coast to Coast. David, you have a home run with Dan Aykroyd in that DVD, my friend.
Yeah, I think we're really making history here in a way. It's a really special night because, you know, this is the first time, as you said, that a major celebrity has disclosed publicly to the world, no, it's not fiction, it's the real thing. And I really admire Dan Aykroyd's courage and thank him for taking that risk to say, okay, let's look at this much more seriously. And people can see the trailer at daufo.com, and there's a link on your site, so you can watch the commercial. And we hope that millions of people see it, and it really affects them, and we can go to the next level with this.
Well, he's got a passion for everything he does,
yes.
his career, and you can tell he's got a passion for this subject of UFOs.
UFOs, life after death, ghosts. I mean, Dan is one of the most open-minded individuals. I mean, I talk to a lot of people. I talk to physicists, scientists. I talk to philosophers. You know, I study world religion. I've been meditating for 25 years now. And I gotta say, he's one of the most interesting people I've ever sat down and talked to. And he's made me laugh harder than almost anyone in Hollywood. I mean, I gotta thank him for that too, because those moments when I see him in his movies. In fact, his recent movie, it was Christmas with the Cranks, and it opens the first time you see him, you know, cause Tim Allen and Jamie Lee Curtis are the stars, you see the back of his head. And he's so intimidating. He's supposed to be this really intimidating neighbor. And I was just cracking up. Tears are pouring down my face just looking at the back of his head.
You know, he's got another Ghostbuster film that I think is coming out in 2008.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, that'll be exciting, too.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of room for Hollywood. I mean, it's pretty clear from the numbers that people want to see more UFO movies. And, you know, I'm actually surprised that Dan wasn't in Men in Black. And maybe if they do a Men in Black 3, you know, they'll put him in there. He's just so incredible to talk to. And I've talked to him about politics, about, you know, the war, about, you know, military. He knows everybody. I mean, Dan knows everybody in the world.
He would have been great as one of the executives in the Men in Black office.
Oh, yeah, or
wouldn't
like
he?
The big boss. I mean, he's... To me, he should run for, I always think of this, he should run for the President of the United States, because in my movie, it opens up with, "Good evening, my fellow Americans. The sighting over Washington has alarmed many of you, however, please." And he's so presidential in his face, you know, that face is just, it's something I'll never forget, just sitting in there in that room and those opening lines. But, you know, he really is, I mean, he's very humble when he says it, but when you watch the film, you'll see, even when you go to UFO conferences, there's not many people as well-spoken on the subject as he is, because he is passionate. He had a sighting. He's been studying it since he was a little kid. And when you have one of these sightings like I did in Berkeley, you know, my mother's a lawyer. Her husband is a lawyer. My father's a PhD in psychology from Berkeley, Lynn Sarita. I could have been a doctor or a lawyer,
sure.
But I saw that UFO, and it's like, sorry, I just kept replaying it and replaying it. And, you know, my mother remarried to a science teacher named David F. Cooper. I was a Cooper myself for about a decade. And I fell in love with science through my stepfather, David Cooper. And that really helped me, you know, focus in a scientific direction at an early age.
No relation to the late astronaut Gordon Cooper, huh?
No, but, you know, there was that Cooper affinity, you know. In fact, Dan Aykroyd and I just got interviewed by Anderson Cooper on CNN, and we're looking for when they're going to run the piece. It was an amazing interview. Whenever I hear the name Cooper, Cooper just means barrel maker. You know, back in the old days, everyone had a name like a smith, you know, a worksmith or a metalsmith. Sarita actually just means Wednesday in Ukrainian. My father's Ukrainian. So a lot of these names are, you know, just really have simple meanings. But for a Cooper, you know, when I heard astronaut Gordon Cooper's sighting, and that's something I want to follow, actually. Let's just kind of zero in there. In our film, you know, we licensed this interview of Gordon Cooper, and we used more of it than the original filmmaker used. And he starts with, you know, post-World War II, in his F-86 fighter jet, he describes chasing these UFOs that are in, like, a formation, a very intelligent formation. And when they try to get close to them, these things just zip around and outperform our jets like nothing. I mean, we can't touch these things.
I mean, it's almost like they let you catch up, then they take off again, and then they let you catch up, and they take off again.
They're just so – I mean, when you – if you look at my theory, which is that we reduce the mass gravity effect of the steel and the pilot. Like, you know, we're all just made of atoms, and atoms are just particles and waves. Now, if the UFO is using a wave generator, this is essentially what I believe, the wave generator transforms mass so that we can reduce the mass down to near zero. So gravity no longer has any effect on it. There's no G-forces. So you could make sudden stops, sudden right-angle turns, and that's how you're able to outperform our jets, because we experience G-forces. We're still using, you know, rocket propulsion and jet and thruster propulsion and propeller propulsion, which, you know, and we still have this heavy relationship to gravity. But when you reduce the mass gravity effect by wave transformation, you're free of that, so you can move like that. So that's Cooper's first sighting. Then in 1958, stationed at what we now call Edwards Air Force Base, which was Muir Rock Field back then,
mm-hmm.
Cooper described seeing this, you know, his crew were installing a new, airplane hangar, and they noticed this, you know, double lenticular craft. Those are the words he used, which means double lens shape, you know, which is what a UFO looks like, a disc-shaped one with a little knob on the top. It lands, it puts out its landing gear, and it lands. His crew films it. They bring him the film, they develop it, he looks at the film, and he says, it's good film, it's probably the best footage of a UFO ever taken, and he sends it to the Pentagon, never to be heard again. Now I have a lot of questions about that. The first is, going further back to the Battle of 42 in Los Angeles, it's February 25th, 1942, the war has just started, we are seeing what appear to be 9 enemy aircraft flying over Los Angeles that are very high altitude. We end up putting all the searchlights up on these things, and we fire 1,400 rounds at them all night long. And one of them gets down really low, and eyewitnesses describe it as amber-colored, disc-shaped. Some people try to describe it as a balloon, but you can't imagine a balloon surviving 1,400 rounds.
Oh, I know, and if they got searchlights on this thing, we had a picture mm-hmm. several months ago on the coasttocoastam.com website. I mean, clearly there's something up there.
Now, see, we're gonna connect to Cooper in a minute, because you're gonna see something really amazing. That's why I'm bringing this up. Now, we open this up in our film, Dan Aykroyd Unplugged on UFOs, like a can of worms. We look at these, you know, majestic documents that were supposedly declassified, signed by George C. Marshall, who was chief of staff of the Army at the time, becomes Secretary of Defense and wins the Nobel Prize for Peace for the Marshall Plan. Now, this is one of the highest credible military officers in our history, and he's saying, according to his reports, they retrieved 2 saucers in the Los Angeles area from that night. They found one off the coast of Long Beach and one in the San Bernardino Mountains. Now, where would they take those crash retrievals but Muir Rock Field or Edwards Air Force
Base?
That's
the closest place they could go.
That's the closest place they could go, and that's February 25th, 1942.
Battle 42,
okay. So now I would hypothesize that if we took them there, and this is all really true, we would be trying to reverse engineer these craft and get them working again. And remember, the number of lights or UFOs in the sky over Los Angeles was 9. They were amber-colored. And just for a moment, I mean, this is another segment in our film, Lynn Kitai's Phoenix Lights case.
Great work she did, by the way.
Following the main giant mile-wide triangle, she found these 3, you know, amber-colored orbs, and she photographed them so beautifully. And we zoom in on them, and they look like disc shape. Double lenticular, just like Cooper describes, and they're amber-colored. And when I put them side-by-side next to the Battle 42, strip the color difference, I'm looking at the same thing. So, you know, just kind of hold that thought. Now we go back to Edwards Air Force Base, where they probably took these things. Now, imagine we fired at these things 1,400 rounds all night. We're not friendly people. The ETs never fired back at us. They're very non-invasive at this point, and in fact, they're not even interested in defending themselves. What happens is, and this is in Preston Dennett's book, UFOs Over California, on July 7th, 1947, a test pilot, Major J.C. Wise, was preparing for takeoff when he saw a yellow, white, spherical object, you know, again, that amber color,
right,
heading over Muir Rock Air Force Base. And then what ends up happening is a series of incredible sightings start to take place over the Air Force Base. And I think, and you'll see why I think this in a minute, I think they're coming back to look for their buddies. because that is the same number. There are, in the report, there are 9 UFOs over Edwards Air Force Base, and this is some years later. This is 1947, you know, 5 years later. And then what happens is, allegedly, and this is a far stretch to prove, but the President of the United States, Eisenhower, goes in to the base and he actually meets the extraterrestrials. And I might even believe this, and I'll tell you why. Because Gordon Cooper, 1958 is his case of the disc landing on the base. Now, we're not friendly people. If we pick up something like this on radar, this is a solid metallic UFO, we're going to fire at it.
Especially during wartime.
And why would you, if you're an extraterrestrial intelligence, why would you land in a military base? And why was there no interceptor jets? There was no intrusiveness on our part on the base. These things land, they film it, nobody knows about it, nobody says anything about it, and the film is developed and it's the end of the story. I think those are the retrieved saucers that we have reverse engineered, and that there really is a communication going on at that base, and our president at the time did know about it. And because it just doesn't add up. It doesn't add up that we're not, you know, we're not firing at these things. We're not, you know, trying to contain them. And, of course, the most, you know, significant thing that doesn't add up is that why would they land there in the first place? It's not a friendly place to land.
How long do you think, David, how long do you think it took to reverse engineer those craft?
Well, I think, you know,
years?
It's a matter of a repair job or possibly the ETs even assisted. I even think, again, you know, Cooper's sighting is 1958. Mine was 1968, and I was roughly looking out towards, and I know the Bay Area of San Francisco well now, on the East Bay, not far from Lawrence Berkeley National Lab, Lawrence Livermore National Lab, and Lawrence Berkeley Lab, which is where all of our, you know, nuclear scientists were working. People like Glenn Seaborg, who, you know, invented.
Oh, the Giants were working there.
They were all working up there, and it wasn't far from there. And why, again, was there the sighting I saw? I mean, I wasn't looking at a balloon. This thing was hovering. There was no noise. It was huge. It was at 3,500 feet, and there were the shimmering waves around it. I remember seeing, you know, when you look at a hot, you know, country road in the middle of the
summer. Yeah, it's got that shimmery effect. Yeah.
Yeah, that's what the UFO looked like up in the sky. It was shimmering, but clearly metallic. Very similar to some of the sightings out of Mexico that we also have in the film. So why is it near Lawrence Livermore, Lawrence Berkeley, and there's nothing, no jets, nothing? This is 1968. We have fighter jets in 1968. We've already broken the sound barrier back in the 1940s. So you got to wonder why. And I remember saying to my friend next to me, saying, you know, you can see USA written on the side of it, because we were Star Trek fans back then, and My Favorite Martian. I used to watch My Favorite Martian.
One of my favorites. Ray Walston, right?
That was a... I remember being sick and being stuck at home and watching My Favorite Martian. To me, it was all so real, because I had already seen the UFO, and there I was watching My Favorite Martian saying, well, yeah, they're all real.
Didn't he have it hidden in the garage?
Yeah, there's something about his garage, and he had his little antennas that would grow out of his head.
Yeah, I loved it.
I can see it in my mind right now, and I'm 44 years old. So if I can remember My Favorite Martian, some people say, well, what could you remember at 7 years old? I mean, I actually remember being baptized when I was 4 months old. I have a very good memory.
Good for you.
But so those are thought-provoking questions about crash retrievals, and this precedes Roswell. Now, the case in Preston Dennett's book of the UFOs over Edwards is July 7th, 1947. Now, that's the same day as the Roswell incident.
Isn't that ironic?
I wonder if we launched fighters and we chased them. Mind you, these things can outdo us, you know, a million times to one. Did we shoot another one down? I mean, is that another possible theory on Roswell? Or why did two UFOs crash in New Mexico, one in Roswell and one at the Plains of St. Augustine on the same day? You know, it's very, very mysterious. And I think, to me, Gordon Cooper's testimony is golden in this film. I mean, it is, you know, James Overook tries to say, who was a Houston control operator at NASA, he tries to debunk Gordon Cooper. Gordon Cooper's a U-2 test pilot, a fighter pilot, an astronaut, probably one of the best expert witnesses you could ever have. He did not suffer mental illness. He suffered from Parkinson's, I believe, and lost control of some of his functions, so he's a little bit slow, but it doesn't mean he's delusional. He's not, you know, he was never determined to be a schizophrenic. his testimony is golden. As far as I'm concerned, if Gordon Cooper said he saw a UFO and he chased it, he did. You cannot question an expert witness and a national hero like that. And even people like, astronaut Edgar Mitchell, who, when I spoke at Roswell at the UFO conference there, he's standing up on the stage and he's talking about UFOs. I mean, what are we going to say? What is our government going to say, and how can the media laugh at our expert witnesses in our own military? You can't tell these people they're crazy. And like Dan said, with Stephen Greer you had on the other night, you cannot laugh at these people. These are our expert witnesses.
You know, I interviewed Gordon Cooper a couple years before he died when I was in St. Louis.
Oh, really?
And I'm saying to myself, this guy has got so much credibility. You know, in an industry, in a field, David, that we've spent a lot of our years, both of us, on just trying to get the information out. I'm there talking to him, saying, you know, he's a former astronaut. He's a jet pilot. He has witnessed UFOs. He's not nuts. He saw something.
Yeah.
It was an amazing feeling for me.
Oh, that would have been golden. I was supposed to be on the Fox News with him. I did a piece on the Fox News local Los Angeles, and he was on the segment, but I never got to actually meet him, and I just would have loved that.
And a wonderful person, by the way.
Yeah, you know, he also did a very similar mission in his life. He was hired by Disney to go out and search alternative energy technologies and zero-point energy devices for Disney to see if any of them were really feasible. And whenever he found one he was interested in, they just simply took the report and didn't really do anything about it. And that's what I spent a lot of my life doing, too. So, you know, I really identify with him. To me, he's one of my great heroes. So I wanted to kind of follow that line, because what we do in this film with Dan Aykroyd is we open up these cans of worms, these segments, and then it's like they're open for discussion. And the Gordon Cooper, there's three segments of him, and then there's the Battle of 42 in the end. And no, there's another thing about the Battle of 42, which is a critique, and a lot of experts say that, well, that night we launched a balloon, and it's not really a UFO when we put the lights up on it. Now, think about this.
It would have blown up with those.
Well, no, think about this. We're being invaded allegedly by the Japanese, and we're going to go, okay, guys, the Japanese are coming in. Let's inflate this balloon.
Yeah, let's launch
a
balloon.
all these military crews to inflate it, and let's put lights on it. Meanwhile, Japan's up there ready to bomb us. And let's just put the lights on the balloon.
That didn't happen. Hey, David, when we come back, I want to hear from you your most compelling UFO case that you've ever heard of.
Okay.
I'll be back in a moment with our guest, David Sirita, on Coast to Coast AM. Well, David, besides Roswell, because I want to get your take on that again, what you talked with me about on our last show together was unbelievable. But what has been, for you, the most compelling UFO story you've ever heard?
Well, it's really going to shock you, actually, but I'll go in an order of three. I think, you know, the Phoenix Lights is one of the most amazing cases of our time, but I would put it at number three. And compare this to, instead of number one, to, you know, Steven Spielberg's Close Encounters of the Third Kind, and he has the three categories, the third kind meaning direct contact.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, you go, you know, for my personal sighting, I would put it number two, because I saw it with my own eyes, and it is, there's no question in my mind that what I saw was real. And, you know, you could put a gun to my head, and I'm not going to tell you anything else. But the most amazing case of all time for me is quite shocking for your audience, but it's the apparitions in 1968, between 1968 and 1970. This only made the back pages of the New York Times back then, but there were full-blown apparitions of the Virgin Mary over a Coptic Christian church in a poor district of Zaytun in Cairo. And accompanied by her in the sky were these UFOs. And they're in these formations that were photographed. In fact, her body of light was photographed. And there were, over a three-year period, there were literally millions of witnesses. So why this is number one for me is because it's not only UFOs in the sky, but it's accompanied by an actual divine personality that is familiar to most of the world. And the number of witnesses, because they were repeated sightings, is in the millions. And the photographs are stunning. I mean, people can see them at zeitun-eg.org on the Internet. And if you look at these photos of the UFOs in the sky, I think these particular kind of UFOs are kind of like the ones that appeared to Enoch, the first prophet in the Bible, the prophet Ezekiel, possibly even Moses on the mountain. These are the angelic UFOs, the highest level ones that I believe are the ones that have access to the singularity that they can move instantly anywhere in the universe.
Well, why did the angelic ones, though, David, need craft?
Well, they're
why
not
don't they just show up?
I mean, these ones I don't believe are machinery. I think they are, in an essence, high vibrational, integrated consciousness and form at the same time. I think, if anything, they're even transmorphic.
But they look like machines.
Well, not the ones in Zaytun. They actually, they're very crisp edges. Some people think they look like doves. I'm looking at them right now. And they're in a kind of a semi-cross formation. And, you know, there's no evidence of steel or structure, especially in nighttime sightings in general. But I think that, you know, I mean, there's a lot in this case. I mean, and again, there were documented healings. There were millions of witnesses. It appeared over a three-year period. There were 700 apparitions, and always in the sky, there they are. And in the year 2000, the BBC reported this on their websites only, and so did ABC News. The small town of Assiut, which is also in Egypt, there were similar sightings and enormous luminous forms of the Virgin Mary and also the bright glowing orbs in the sky accompanied by them. So when we look at Spielberg's criteria, you have a craft. Okay, we had a craft at Roswell and we had alien bodies, but how many people saw the alien bodies? It's only
just a few.
But in this case, we have craft or possibly spiritual temples in the sky seen by millions repeatedly over a three-year period and photographed very well. The photographs are very compelling. So when you look at all three criteria and the fact that we're looking at a divine personality, I mean, this is really amazing to me how few people know about this, but it's a divine personality that so many people are familiar with that walked in the flesh, and here we are seeing her in this luminous body of light that's really, you know, identifiable. I mean, this isn't blurry stuff. I mean,
would you categorize this as a UFO sighting, or is it strictly a very spiritual endeavor?
No, I would categorize it as a UFO sighting because, to me, UFOs are unidentified flying objects, and it doesn't, you know, there are those that are machines that can reduce their mass, and essentially they look like they're turning into light, but they're really just, you know, reducing their mass gravity effect by wave transformation. But I think these, and I've had personal experiences with some of these ones that I believe are more just, there's no machinery involved. These are pure, you know, high vibration consciousness integrated with, you know, spiritual temples. I don't even know what to call them. They are UFOs. They have shape. They're, some of them, you know, even what the prophet Ezekiel saw in the Bible was clearly, you know, vortexes of energy spinning out of these disc-shaped forms, and he described beings on these craft. And the prophet, the first prophet in the Bible, of course, is Enoch. You know, he's only three down from Adam and Eve, and he describes seeing this disc shape. This is in the Book of Enoch, translated by the Archbishop of Cashel, Richard Lawrence, and it's clear that he's looking at a disc with a dome roof, which Enoch describes the running of stars, meaning as he got into it and they started moving through space, stars were going by. And if stars are going by, unless you're just panning across the panorama of stars, you're actually moving through them. The distance between stars is so great, you're doing hyper, you know, light speed travel. You're going many, many thousands of times the speed of light. And I believe Enoch, his experience was on not a machine. I think it was a one of these spiritual temple UFOs.
Well, explain to me why I'm disappointed, and let me explain.
Yeah, I know. I said it would shock you.
Yeah. Well, let me explain what I mean by that, David. Mm-hmm. You know, I believe in a divine creator. Mm-hmm. I believe there's a higher power out there that has formed whatever we're talking about. Mm-hmm. How? I have no idea, but I believe that there is. Mm-hmm. I am beginning to believe that the texts of the past, of antiquity, were dealing with extraterrestrial visitation somehow.
Oh, yeah.
What they witnessed were these UFOs, these extraterrestrials, and they somehow have turned them and created them into our gods. Mm-hmm. That, to me, is a reality, a very likely story, but it's disappointing to me.
Yeah, but see, that, you know, the issue of God is not what I'm going into and why I'm so impressed with the sighting, because that's a very personal area for people. I'm not bringing up the issue of God in relation to ufology. I'm only looking at this as a case for documentation, photographs, the number of witnesses, and identifiable, you know, light phenomena or UFOs in the sky. And when you look at those three criteria, there's nothing else that I know of. The Phoenix Lights is pretty amazing because it happened in our time. And in fact, Lynn Kitai, you know, the woman who had the experiences, we did a segment in our Dan Aykroyd film with her. She feels very spiritual about the contacts because they're not intrusive. They're silent. They're not bombing us, these ETs. They're very peaceful. In this case, there are no cases of abductions in relation to those sightings that were, you know, intrusive or violent. So she really feels very spiritual about it. And, you know, I'm not debating, you know, whose religion is superior just because I'm bringing this up. That's not what this is about.
No, I understand, but I mean...
And I appreciate that everyone has their own views on that, but I am so impressed with this because of those three criteria.
Sure.
What other site... I mean, the Phoenix Lights, they say, may have had 10,000 witnesses.
Yeah.
And that's a big number.
Yeah,
it's
huge.
That's why I put it in my number
three
slot, because my sighting I know happened because I saw it, and so did the witnesses around me. And I'm amazed that no one took a 16 or Super 8 millimeter film that day and got it, because it was hovering for a good 20 minutes. That's plenty of time to go get your camera. I mean, Patrick Usgard in Venice, when he saw the UFO, he was at Venice Beach. He ran home and had time to get his camera and catch the tail end of it when it was a little further away. But when his UFO was closer, he said everyone thought it was a hubcap flying up there, and that's what it looked like. And I wish he had his camera when it was closer. You know, some people complain about, well, the video is a bit grainy, it's a bit far away. Well, sorry that, like I said, a Paramount film crew doesn't stand around looking in the sky with these big 70-millimeter cameras. I wish they did. And I would actually like to next go into a building a chasing UFOs unit for television and actually go out there and get closer to the phenomena with bigger lenses. But it really has to do with those three criteria, the numbers of witnesses and the confirmation of multiple sightings in the same area. I mean, you have the incidents, like, for example, we have Mark Olson up in Sonora, California, who's getting repeated sightings that are in our film. We have Jeff Willis in Phoenix, as well as Lynn Kitai. A lot of people are getting continuing sightings in the Phoenix area, and I think that is incredibly significant for us because it's right in our backyard. We need to get closer. We need to get longer lenses, better film. If there's something happening on a regular basis in a certain area, we need to get closer. And I'm willing to do that. I mean, I'm a skydiver. I've jumped at night. I've jumped at 24,000 feet. I am not afraid to get close to these things. And if I have to, if I had a funded unit, I would do it to bring, you know, sharper, clear, you know, videography or filmography of these objects to find out what they are. I mean, Mark Olson, I was up in Sonora, California with my fiance, Crystal, and we were interviewing Mark for a segment for this other film I did, and we wanted to have our own sighting because I have a big Canon XL1 really sharp video camera. He's got his little video cameras. And we got tired, and Patrick Usgard was camped out there, and we wanted to have our own sighting, and we didn't. I went, so we got in the car, and I get a call on the cell phone, come back, get back here. And I'm racing, you know, back and running up the stairs, and Mark just videoed a triangle in the middle of the day in a clear blue sky. You can see these three white lights, and this is in the Dan Aykroyd movie. You can see this, and my editor, John Johnson, and producer, we zoomed in on it, and oh my God, it's a daylight triangle, but you can't see the mass in the center, the actual structure. You can just see the three lights.
Well, how do you know there weren't just three lights then?
Because you know, I've seen birds fly in formation and jets fly in formation, and I've seen other photographs like the one you guys have up on your website. I don't know if you know that one. It was a kid who took a picture and his father. You can see the crisp edges of the triangle and those three lights in the exact same formation. I think the mass is invisible in that case. I really do.
Cloaked, maybe?
It's cloaked, and that's why
that's possible.
A lot of these digital cameras pick them up. So when you have continuous phenomena going on in these kind of areas, That's why we need to have a unit. It's almost like a Ghostbusters unit. We want to have a UFO Busters unit and just get close. And, you know, maybe we'll get to the next level of contact.
Well, I hope so, David, except I believe that Dan Aykroyd is correct when he said government is not going to disclose. They're not going to tell us.
But we don't need them to tell us because there's thousands of sky watchers out there with video cameras that are getting videotapes, like the caller who called in. I always say this. We've already had disclosure because we have our, thanks to Stephen Greer, we got project disclosure. We got commercial airline pilots, military pilots, and astronauts testifying that, yes, it's real. So we have disclosure. The mainstream media may not accept that, but you cannot deny expert witnesses in a courtroom. If we took these guys in a courtroom, it's already happened. The problem is that the world doesn't know about it yet. So what I say is to even Gary McKinnon, you want proof of disclosure, watch Dan Aykroyd Unplugged on UFOs and look at all the footage and look at what we're saying. It's already happened. You don't need to hack into a government computer to find out. Now, you know, Stephen Bassett, who, you know, runs Paradigm Research Group, mm-hmm. tells me that full disclosure is when the government comes to the public and says, it's real, it's happening, and here's what we're doing about it. Now, that is what everybody wants.
That's not going to happen.
We either want a Buick to land on the White House lawn from outer space and out come the men in black and say we're real, we're from the planet Venus like Valiant Thor, the story in the 1950s with Dr. Strange's. You know, that's what we want to happen, but it's not the way it's happening. We kind of have to just accept the way it's happening. Disclosure is happening thanks to your show especially. It already is happening. But what do we want to do about it? I want to first get closer to the phenomenon, and then second, my greatest passion is in aerospace, is to, you know, reverse engineer the technology. I don't like to rely on the idea, although I believe that we probably have reverse engineered a certain amount of the technology, but I don't want to rely on that. That's why I'm so interested in finding out how these craft work. And in fact, John, my producer and editor, John Johnson, and I were sitting on my computer editing the film, and Jeff Willis gave me some stunning footage out of Phoenix, Arizona. And it was a UFO hovering over his house, and when we zoom in on it, you can clearly see that it is translucent, that you can see through to the center of the craft, and you can see the kind of outline shape of the disc. And it reminded me, and this will shock your viewers a little bit too, I have very good footage from Neil Armstrong's first step on the moon. And I know a lot of your viewers don't believe we went there.
I do.
This particular footage, when he's stepping on the moon, it's only one camera. You can see right through his body. He is translucent. He looks like a ghost. And I am not imagining this. It is very clear as he steps off that ladder on this one camera that he is translucent.
Now, what are you saying, though, about that?
Well, what's happening in my theory is that the camera, you know, remember the moon doesn't have an atmosphere. So a lot of the intense ultraviolet light that is coming from our sun and the odd X-ray burst, these wavelengths pass right through solid objects like butter. And then, of course, you have a lot of visible light mixed in that, you know, that doesn't pass through it as much. It's not as penetrative. So the camera is sensitive to those, you know, very high-frequency photons, and so it presents the translucency of what we really are. We're just particles and waves. And in that particular instance, I believe the ultraviolet light that the moon doesn't have an atmosphere. It's just passing through his body. Now, when we go back to the UFO in Phoenix, the one that, you know, John and I were analyzing, you can see right through it. And there is something in the middle of the UFO. And I didn't put this in the film. I mean, this is classified stuff that is the last secret that I was looking for in their propulsion systems. And it's so brilliant. When I sent it to John Hutchison, I've got seven pages of, you know, the photographs with arrows pointing to the different segments. He said, "Oh my God, David, that's it." That's what John Hutchison said, our friend John Hutchison. And he said, I am ready to do experiments. And I sent the same presentation to my contacts at NASA. There are two top contacts I have there. And everyone's really interested in this discovery, this revolutionary discovery, because we're able to see through translucently the UFO. And that's because the UFO is starting to produce higher and higher frequency wavelengths, which to the naked eye, you wouldn't see this. But the video camera and the camera can experience it. So when you translate it into you know, onto your video screen, it's like, oh my God, look what it captured. It's like a, it's like an X-ray oncologist. He takes your X-ray, and when he takes the photograph, you don't see your bones, but when you look at the photo, oh, there's your bones. You can see right through, and you can see the flash. Well, that's kind of like what we're looking at in this UFO. And in some video frames, it's clearly solid. It's a disc-shaped object with a dome on the top, and then a couple of frames later, you'll see these different colors around it, like violets and reds, and it's strobing in the rainbow spectrum. And then, you know, several more frames, you can see right through the thing. And there's something in the middle, and I got to tell you, it is shocking. I was sitting here, and even my fiance Crystal's little cousin, he's only like, you know, 12 years old. He's looking at it, and he figured it out. He went, "Oh my God! Look, you can." I didn't even have to say a word; he knew what it was.
David, when we come back, we'll get your take on Roswell with your incredible theory, and we have posted right under Mr. Sarita's name on the coasttocoastam.com website, those photographs that he was talking about of what he believes to be the most compelling UFO story he has ever heard. Tell us the version we all know about Roswell, and then tell us your take on it.
Okay, sure. I mean, we all know that on roughly between July 7th, 1947, we, you know, had, there were two cases, one at Roswell and one at the plain of St. Augustine's, just north of there, northwest of there. Two UFOs crashed, possibly more, and that we were told, of course, it was a weather balloon. And, you know, it's funny because in New Mexico is an amazing state to me, and there's a lot of amazing history there. First, we have the, you know, atomic bomb. The first test was on July. You get different dates on the test for Trinity. Was July 5th or the 7th,
mm-hmm.
You know, roughly the same dates as Roswell, 1945. And then, of course, you had in 1947,
you mean?
No, that's Roswell. But in the 1960s, Captain Joe Kittinger set the world record skydive from 103,000 feet from a weather balloon. And when he jumped in free fall, he actually created a sonic boom. He did over 700 miles an hour in free fall. And so, you know, and I've seen a lot of that footage. I'm a skydiver. I know what weather balloons look like, and I know, you know, a lot about, I know what it's like to be out there a lot. I've got over 200 skydives. And, you know, when they try to tell you that when you understand how a weather balloon moves, you know, how slowly it inflates and how slowly it reaches the altitude, you know, that it needs to, you know, to be in these positions, and you think that Roswell is just suddenly, you know, a balloon, mm-hmm. that went awry. It looks so ridiculous. It's one of those things where the public loses faith and credibility with the military and with the government because they really think we're stupid.
Especially with the changed story.
Especially with the changed story.
That to me tells you everything.
You first announced that, you know, they retrieved a saucer, there was a crash, and then all of a sudden it's a weather balloon and there were crash test dummies. Do you think we really... expert witnesses don't know the difference between a crash test dummy and some fleshy, you know, living creature. I mean, they really take us for idiots, and they got to stop doing that. And this stuff about the planet Venus, I mean, Venus is the most amazing planet in the solar system. It's everywhere. It's hovering over people's houses. It's up in the sky. I mean, they got to stop this. And so that's Roswell. Now, I think there's a connection in my theory, and as I evolved my theoretical work in how UFOs fly and the wave transformation of mass, how they have wave generators in the center of them and they're able to transform their mass, I looked at Roswell and I looked at the Trinity, the first nuclear test we ever did, and I said, you know, these dates are really, they're the same dates, but it's 2 years later. And the other peculiar thing I said, I realized, well, both crashes are on either side of Trinity. One is at Roswell, which is just, like, I think, southeast of Trinity site. And the other one is Plains of St. Augustine's, which is northwest of the site. Now, that's a little bit odd. So I thought, what if? I mean, I know about time dilation in Einstein physics. I mean, the faster you accelerate in an Einstein equation, time value starts to slow down, or perception of time slows down. But another thing happens with time is when frequency of the wave formation of the brain accelerates in higher frequency states, time slows down. For example, when you go to sleep at night, your brain slows down, And when you're really in deep theta sleep or delta, your brain waves are very long and slow frequency, and huge quanta of time go by like that. You know, like, you know, 4 or 5 hours, 6 hour chunks are gone in what appear to be seconds in your mind if you're in a deep state. But when your brain's very active doing sports, it peaks at around 100 waves per second or 100 hertz a second. Anyone who has hit a tennis ball, you know, at 100 miles an hour, like John McEnroe, can tell you that the moment he's contacting that ball, it's like slow motion. I mean, I know what it's like to skydive and to do extreme skiing and jump into avalanche chutes, and I know, you know, that feeling where a whole second becomes an eternity. But this is simple Einstein physics. So if the craft itself, this is my hypothesis, were vibrating in the ultraviolet spectrum or higher, and literally they were probably very curious about what we were doing at Trinity that day. We had never achieved anything like this before. There were no previous tests of the nuclear bomb. And they're hovering around in this interdimensional place, vibrating perhaps even as high as the gamma spectrum or ultraviolet or X-ray. And that's the frequency vibration of their craft. We can't see them, but they can see us and they can see Trinity. Now, when the bomb goes off, there is an intense 200 million electron volt burst of gamma radiation, 200 MeV total. There's about, I think, about 5 MeV gammas. But it's kind of like a surfer in the ocean. When a wavelength that is equal to your wavelength passes through you, it hits you physically and shoves you over. But if a wavelength passes through my body like an X-ray, and my body's vibrating in a very low frequency form, the X-ray will pass through me and it won't be able to push me. So I think what happened, that intense burst of gammas knocked two interdimensional UFOs on either side of Trinity, and we didn't see the effects for 2 years later on the same days.
That's interesting.
Due to time dilation.
So that's what you meant by 45.
Yeah, because 1945 was Trinity.
All right.
And that's when we tested the first nuclear bomb. And then Roswell, there's two crashes on either side of Trinity that roughly the same dates, you know, July 7th through the 9th or the 12th, 1947. So I think there's a connection there.
Sounds like the Philadelphia experiment, sort of.
Yeah, exactly. You know, when you start getting in these other dimensions, time, and I'm finding out more and more as I apply my singularity theory, for example, to the Big Bang, I'm really seeing the birth of time, how at singularity, absolute singularity, there is no time and there is no space distance because there's no resistance. There's no inertia to slow things down. But at just prior to the Big Bang, in this infinitum of energy in the singularity, an absolute zero time value, zero space value, as soon as you give birth to duality, the first duality, you have resistance. Positive and negative are born. You have friction, which produces heat, which produces resistance, and the universe starts to, it appears to be expanding at an incredible rate at the moment of the Big Bang because time is being born, and inertia, resistance, is causing an absolute instantaneity and infinity to slow down. So time is born, and when you can see time being born and how time actually works, you can understand a concept like this, that these craft that are jumping from dimension to dimension don't experience time the way we do. So why did the crash happen 2 years later on either side? That is because once their waves slowed down, because we distorted their wave generator with that enormous burst, they eventually enter our time value domain, and then they become very physical, and then, of course, they go flying off, and they're very badly damaged. You know, I was always curious about the dates. Is that a coincidence that on either side of Trinity we got two UFO crashes?
There are no coincidences.
And then there was the one up at Corona, New Mexico. And,
right,
of course, you know, Los Alamos National Lab is probably the place that they would have taken the crash retrieval, just like in the case of the Battle of 42, they probably would have taken it to Edwards Air Force Base, what we now call Edwards Air Force Base. And back then, I think, you know, that's where they built the bomb. I think if they retrieved the saucers, it would have gone to Los Alamos.
Yeah, all right. Given that is the correct theory, it still tells you, though, that there was a visitation and that there were bodies.
Oh, yeah.
And all that stays the same, right?
Yeah, I believe there was. I mean, I trust Colonel Philip Corso. And a lot of these guys, you know, when they reach their retirement, and they're getting near the end of their life, and they swore to secrecy, they're starting to tell all. you know, and I you know, they're expert witnesses, in my opinion. You cannot question a military officer like Gordon Cooper or Colonel Philip Corso when they say this is happening. Why would they just make this stuff up? There's just no, there's nothing, it's pure nonsense that they were making it up, and I really don't believe they would. And the debunkers just come out and say, well, they're making it up, and, you know, he was crazy, and it's not really real. But who are they? Who are debunkers?
What is your take on the former Canadian Defense Minister, Paul Hellyer, who's in your Dan Aykroyd Unplugged on the UFOs video, primarily because he does admit that during his Defense Department days, unless he told you something otherwise, he didn't know much about UFOs until he read The Day After Roswell by Corso, and realized that there was something going on. But I was a little disappointed in the story of Hellyer that I heard a couple months ago, David, because I had thought he was intricately involved in knowing something, and apparently he wasn't.
They may not disclose that they were, but this is another one of those cases where he's reaching, you know, near the end of his life, you know, and assuming he's not going to live past 100.
Yeah, what is he, 82 now?
Yeah. You know, he may still have another decade or two left, but this is when they want to talk. And he may have been more, you know, inclined to say something earlier if he wasn't afraid for his life. Maybe now he's not afraid. And I also think he trusts Corso as an expert witness because he's a military man himself. It's that kind of bond you have. You know, you don't lie in the military. You don't make up fiction, you know, for the point of entertainment. And I think Paul Hellyer coming forward not only is because of Corso, although he does talk about Corso, it's about the enormous amount of sightings they've had in Canada, and you know, 3 million Canadians claim to have seen UFOs, and there's only, what, 50 million Canadians, 35 or 50 million Canadians up there. That's not very many people. And it's really a historical moment for someone at his, you know, his
stature,
to
sure,
come forward, although he does rely a lot on Corso.
Yes.
But that's that bond you have, you know, with expert witnesses.
Well, he believes Corso. There's no doubt about
that.
Oh,
yeah, and he should, because a military man cannot give a false testimony in a court of law, and he wouldn't do it. Absolutely, I do not believe Corso would do it. And I don't believe Cooper would do it. I don't believe Edgar Mitchell would do it. And I think we might even see, again, you know, with the release of this film, some of the expert. I mean, John Schussler testifies in our film, who was a NASA contractor, who's now the head of MUFON.
Yep.
And I asked, you know, John in a personal interview, I said, what are you doing here? And why are you the head of MUFON? And he said, because he wants to know how these things fly. So that means he believes they're real. And James Olberg used to work for Schussler at NASA. He was beneath him. And you have Olberg, who's tried to debunk me on the Art Bell, my first Art Bell show I ever did.
Yeah.
And then you have Schussler at NASA, who's collecting astronaut reports and keeps accurate files of every word the astronaut said. James McDivitt sightings of the UFO on the Gemini mission, Gordon Cooper, he keeps files. So why would one guy at NASA be keeping files if they weren't real and the other one's debunking them?
Do you think that Neil Armstrong saw something when he stepped foot on the moon?
I think it's very possible that some of the what appear to be staged broadcasts from you know, movie sets of the moon were given to us because they saw things up there that they didn't want us to see.
Hence the confusion on whether we went or not.
Hence the confusion. I mean, that's you, if once you polarize an issue, it kind of goes into a standstill, just like global warming. You know, you have, as soon as you polarize it, nobody really, you know, I mean, I think most people believe we went to the moon.
All right, I do too. But you do believe, though, we could have been given, intentionally or otherwise, staged photographs.
Yes, I do. I'm convinced some of those. I mean, the woman in Australia who saw the Coke bottle floating by, the coded letters on the rocks, you know, that's highly suspicious.
Uh-huh.
But I believe we were there. I asked about the Van Allen radiation belt problem, and some of my good friends argue with me that there's no way you could pass through them. But remember, when you pass your finger through a candle, it doesn't burn when you pass through it quick enough. And it's very similar, according to people I know at NASA, with going through the Van Allen belt.
But go through it slowly.
You're going through it at several thousand miles an hour. It doesn't affect you hardly at all. It's just a flicker. You know, I know it's a very wide belt, but they're doing, I think the Apollo missions to the moon averaged about 3,300 miles per hour, if I'm not mistaken. I've looked at that, and that's amazingly fast.
Well, they got there in 3 days.
Yeah. So, And also, of course, the moon is the place where, you know, the most energetic nuclear fuel that we know of, helium-3, the moon dust is loaded with it, and it's very possible ETs, you know, like Hoagland, has shown that they are, you know, there are mining operations for helium-3 on the moon. But, you know, another witness we have in our film is Ken Storch, U.S. Air Force retired. He describes us going to DEF CON, the one just before you go to launching our nuclear weapons against Russia. We thought they were firing nuclear weapons at us, and really they were just UFOs. And we were debating with them, oh, my God, you know, what's coming to our country? What are you firing at us? And we thought we had to launch our nuclear weapons against Russia. And that's a pretty amazing thing to happen because UFOs have the power to if we don't disclose the UFO phenomenon, it doesn't become well known in the military, and someone sees something coming in on radar at that velocity, you're going to think it's a missile because airplanes don't fly faster than Mach 3.
Yeah, that was a tense period.
Yeah, and some of these missiles are going beyond Mach 3, so we know it's not an aircraft, so it's got to be a missile, and that's a very powerful situation if you don't educate your officers that, you know, about the UFO phenomena.
How many presidents do you think since Eisenhower do you think, oh, let's even go back, Truman, how many do you think were told about the UFO issue?
All of them. I think they all know, but I don't think.
All right, so Truman knew?
I think they all knew.
Eisenhower?
Absolutely.
Kennedy?
Kennedy, absolutely.
Some people say that's why he got killed. He was going to say something about that.
He's my
Johnson, you think they told him?
Johnson? Oh, absolutely. I think they, but now how much access those presidents have, I think, is very, very weak. Well, I don't think our current president has very good access to them.
All right, we know Nixon knew because he took Jackie Gleason to Homestead Air Force Base in Florida.
Yeah, and there's the statements by Clinton that there's two things he wanted to know, Kennedy, who killed Kennedy and UFOs. I mean, they want to know, but they really don't know that much. And one of the reasons why is because their position is, you know, 4 year to possibly 8 year, you know, year term, and they're transitory positions, and they don't really have the consistency that these highest levels of our militaries have. So I don't think they even have a need to know.
How about Carter?
Oh, definitely. He had his own experience. You know, he was
right.
He talked about
it. Jerry Ford.
Ford. Oh yeah, yeah. I think these guys all know, but now. Whether I think this is where we're making our mistake. I think Congress has to confirm that we are working on this seriously, not as a joke, not like these constant, you know, debunking flies that are going around in our faces. We need to confirm this, and we need to know that we are working on reverse engineering their technology, because we know from news reports and China Net Daily that China is spending $20 million just to start on UFO research. We know that, and Russian cosmonauts have fully disclosed that they have seen UFOs on the Russian space station Mir. We know that in Turkey and also in, even in Iran, they are studying UFOs seriously. Now, in the event that any of these other countries figure out true anti-gravity first, and we remember Gordon Cooper describing how easily they out, you know, perform our best fighter jets, we could lose air superiority. Now, I'm all for the technology for the world and peace and having, you know, using the technology universally so we can explore the universe and not using it as warfare technology. I don't even believe the Wright brothers, you know, wanted airplanes, you know, to bomb people. I think they just loved flying. And I feel that way about UFO technology. I don't believe that. But unfortunately, history has proven with the advent of new technology, we can go back from the atomic bomb backwards to the airplane to, you know, the invention of, you know, gunpowder all the way into China. And you find that every time there's an advantage in technology, somebody uses it to oppress or to literally take over another country.
David, when we come back, I want to ask you if what I hear is true, that you might be trying to build an anti-gravity saucer.
Well, that's what I was talking about earlier. This new discovery that I have made, I've got blueprints now. I think I'm ready to do it.
All right. Well, tell us about this when we come back. This is interesting. Plus, I know you're advocating a UFO research center. We'll talk about that as well. I'm George Norrie, our guest tonight, David Sirita. And the next hour, we'll open up the phone lines for you right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, David Sirita, our guest. David, let's talk first about the UFO Research Center, then your push for anti-gravity for the rest of this hour.
Mm-hmm.
The UFO Research Center, what's happening there?
Well, you know, I have seriously had some, you know, people who claim to be investors approach me about the idea of putting together a consortium of top people in the zero-point field and anti-gravity fields like John Hutchison and myself and many others, and putting them all under one roof and dividing up the share value equally so that we can all problem solve together and try to produce true anti-gravity. And now there are two individuals at NASA, well, one very high up over there, and I've even had meetings at Los Alamos National Labs, if you can believe it. You know, Scout's honor. I was a Boy Scout.
I believe you, David.
Yeah, I'm just saying that, you know, because I like to. It's a big claim, but there have been a lot of people interested in my theoretical work. But they all say the same thing. You know, we wish we had more money at Los Alamos and at NASA to test some of these ideas because, you know, I don't believe I have all the answers, but I believe all of us collectively do. And I think there's enough, you know, guys like Hutchison and others out there that if we get them all together and we fund a research group, if one of us is right or collectively we're right, this will be the biggest revolution in aerospace. And we need to do this. I mean, that's what, you know, life was like for Nikola Tesla. You know, J.P. Morgan just threw money at him, and he was able to do this. So the two ways I'm looking at, you know, people who say that they will be able to eventually fund something like this. But I'm hoping to, you know, through this first movie, if people buy millions of the video, which would be wonderful, I can take a huge chunk of that to start the lab. And or if I'm able to do some other bigger feature film projects that I have and get myself in the movie business and kind of go in the direction that Steven Spielberg inspired on the world, and I can get a blockbuster movie, I can make enough money to start a lab. And, you know, and just throw money, you know. So what if 10% of them are kooks or they I don't even believe anyone is really a kook. I mean, I've met a lot of wacky.
They're airplanes. Just different. People
no,
are just different.
They're just passionate guys who think they have an idea that might work.
Right. They may be off the wall.
Try it. Try it, because what if they're right? What if one of them is right? Then we can all benefit. And that's the way the world used to be. I mean, Tesla didn't have to write theoretical papers in physics to prove that he could do remote control. He just said, I can do it, and said, oh, cool. A lot of the scientists in his day disagreed with him, but J.P. Morgan gave him the money, and now we have remote control.
I was at a conference a couple of years ago, David, and someone came up to me and said, hey, can you keep a secret? And it wasn't UFO Phil, who calls in every once in a while with that. And I said, well, all depends. What are you going to tell me? He said, well, you have to tell me first. And I said, all right, I won't tell anybody. And then he said, I'm going to show you my perpetual motion machine. And I said, oh, are you? Okay, I'm interested. And my producer, Tom, was sitting on the other side of this guy. And he said, well, I don't have it with me, but I have pictures of it on my cell phone. Would you like to see it? And I said, sure. And he said, you promise you won't tell anybody? And I said, I told you I won't tell anybody. Of course, now I'm telling everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And so he began to thumb through these photos on his cell phone. And they were toilet bowl parts.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm looking at this apparatus. Mm-hmm. You know, he's got the thing that plunges up and down, and then the little rubber ball thing that blocks the water from. And I'm looking at this thing and going, what is this? He says, well, this is the makings of my perpetual motion machine.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked at him, and I said, does it work? And he went, well, no, I haven't figured it out yet.
Oh, my God.
I mean, the bottom line is this guy is dead serious.
Yeah.
Seemed like a nice guy. He was at a conference. He was trying to unveil it to everybody. But I looked at what he was doing, David, and I went, this thing's not going to go anywhere.
Yeah, see, that's what I mean. There's, you know, I try to weed out all those guys, and the ones that I think have the most sound theory, you know, throw money at them. And, you know, I thought, you know, that's what Joe Firmage was going to do when he founded Space Sciences. And he did, and he started to, and then he kind of just stopped. And, in fact, I always called Joe on his cell phone and tried to get him interested, and he just never really wanted to do anything. But you either need someone who's an eccentric billionaire like the Rockefellers were when they funded
something. Well, like Paul Allen's doing for SETI.
Yeah.
You know, $15 million he's donated, and maybe he'll put in more. I mean, he doesn't care what happens to it, and that's an amazing feeling to be able to do that.
That's what we need in America, because that's how we got here. That's why we have television. That's why Edison invented the phonographic record, the motion picture, because people just put money in ideas. And, you know, they don't all have to be right. But, you know, you use your best judgment. And I, if I had $15 million, I would first fund, you know, helium-3 fusion research because I think it's very feasible. Some breakthroughs in solar power, like Michael Fulton, who you had on last night, and whom I know. We've met through your show and an incredible friendship with him. And I would then start going into some of these zero-point devices. I would fund people like Stephen Okerlund, whom I know, one of the most brilliant zero-point scientists I've ever met. His knowledge is incredible. But, you know, you need to get them all under one roof and get them all working together. And, you know, John Hutchison has already proven anti-gravity, but he can't do it every time. He doesn't have control of it. When Hutchison saw my drawings, not my drawings, my the photographs that I broke down of this UFO over Phoenix, he went, oh, my God, that's it's like the last missing clue to perfect the Hutchison effect. And so if I could either get an eccentric millionaire, that would be great, and I have a few people in contact with me, but I've never seen a dime yet. But I don't wait for anybody.
Talk is cheap, huh, David?
Talk is cheap. I got rejected by, you know, I wrote a movie script in the 1980s that was the opposite of The Exorcist. It was a little girl, the same kind of a family situation as Poltergeist, but she's getting visited by angels instead of the devil. And, you know, I came so close and everyone was interested, but nobody wanted to do that. And so eventually I got tired of writing screenplays. And I just said, I'm going to learn how to edit video. I'm going to make movies myself. And when I made Dan Aykroyd and Plugged On UFOs, I just said, you know, let's just do this. So John Johnson and I, thanks to him, you know, I teamed up with him and my friend Henrik, and we made Evidence the Case for NASA UFOs, and Dan appeared in that. And then it was just this ongoing, you know, incredible dialogue with Dan Aykroyd. And I said, let's just, we got to sit you down, Dan, because you're the man to tell the world, you know, what you know and what's really going on, because people will listen to you.
Are you amazed at the publicity that you've gotten with Dan on this?
Yeah, because I don't even think what the bleep do we know got on Greta Von Susteren on Fox.
No, I don't think so.
And, you know, we got interviewed by Anderson Cooper, and I pray that they run it this week.
And I was going to be on MSNBC with you two, but I couldn't make it because because of the time. But they wanted me in there too, and I would have had a great time doing that.
Yeah, that's great. I think they would. You know, they're afraid of the issues, but their ratings would go up, just like Dan said. And that one network that called him up, that network in Chicago, the news network. If you talk about UFOs,
Cleveland,
the ratings go up. And so why not? If the ratings are going to go up, you know. My film is a, you know, there are a lot of good UFO films out there, but this film is special because it's Dan Aykroyd. He's got probably over 100 million fans worldwide, probably way over that. Everybody loves him. And he it's kind of like sitting down with him in a room and seeing amazing footage going by, amazing, you know, discussion. And really touching on the subject.
Well, not only was it a treat hearing him talk about Coast to Coast, it was a treat talking to him, period.
I know, because, you know, when you see him in Ghostbusters and Sneakers, you get this sense of the guy and how what a brilliant comic he is. But then you wonder, what does he think about every day? And that's when you have him on your radio show, and he's just, you know, everybody loves Dan.
He's a real guy, and that, I think, is one of the reasons why he's so successful.
He's so sincere, and he's so warm, and he's friendly to everybody. You should have seen him. I mean, my friend called me up in New York and said people are lined up around the block at the FYI store. It's like Star Wars. You'd think it was something that big. And it's because they love him so much. And they, you know, who's going to write a bad, who's going to say anything bad about Dan Aykroyd? You can't do it.
Well, but regardless, it's a great DVD.
Yeah. I hope millions of people see it. And I hope we can use this to further the process of disclosure. And I think this is a good first step because it's the first celebrity, major celebrity, who has come forward to say it's all real. I mean, even Spielberg never said on national television UFOs are real.
No, he's never admitted that. I have my suspicions what he knows.
Yeah.
But he's never come out publicly other than maybe his personality of his films, which is also another thing.
I think he's saying it. But, you know, I met David Duchovny from The X-Files, you know, actually just saw him in a restaurant and came up to him and gave him my UFO film, and he said, I don't believe in UFOs. He said, that's just an acting role. And I was like, what? Are you kidding? After all those nine seasons on the X-Files.
Yeah, don't tell me. You'll ruin the event for me. You probably should have told him.
But apparently Dana Scully is the real believer. Now, the lone gunman, you know, Dean Hegwin, who's one of the lone gunmen, which was the three tech guys in the X-Files, and he had his own show called The Lone Gunman. He's visited me a couple of times. His office is across the street, and
yeah.
He's a believer. A firm believer in UFOs, and he's speaking. I'm speaking at the Bay Area UFO conference in September.
I will see you there.
And so is Dino. You'll be there.
Yeah, I'm going to be there for a little.
That's
bit.
The biggest turnout of any place in the country. If people want to come and meet everybody, come to the Bay Area conference and meet everybody there.
Okay, but anyway, you're working on blueprints to
build
an anti-gravity.
I've got blueprints now because these video frames are so good. And I had already, you know, come up with an experimental design for a wave generator used to transform the mass. But this revolution, there's no way to describe it on the phone and over the air. You have to see the drawings. But yet, if I show the drawings, I'm very patriotic. I don't want any other country but ours to look at this. And the two people I have at NASA are very serious people. They're very interested in looking at them, and they've been examining them. And, you know, I'm waiting to hear back from them. But, you know, the only other place I would go is people I trust. I wouldn't publicly disclose these photographs, because they're too powerful. John Hutchison has seen them, and if you ever have him on again, just ask him, and he'll tell you. Because if anybody knows, it's John Hutchison. He has gotten closer to, well, he's already produced true anti-gravity, but he's, you know, he hasn't mastered it yet. But nobody has done what John Hutchison has done, and I trust his opinion.
I was going to say, what do you think of him as a scientist?
Oh, I think he is I call him an accidental genius. He's an intuitive genius because, you know, he does understand a lot about physics and engineering, but he intuited his way into this discovery. And he's really an amazing guy. I mean, I think he's one of those guys who deserves to be hired by, you know, I called up NASA's Breakthrough Propulsion Physics Lab, Mark Millis, who's around the same age as I am, in his 40s, and I said to him, have you heard of the Hutchison effect? And they go, oh, yeah, we all know who John Hutchison is. I mean, everybody at NASA knows. And that was pretty comforting, you know, all these guys, including my other contacts, whose names I won't give out, they all know about him. And so I said, and they said, well, we tried to duplicate it, and we couldn't get it to do it. So I thought, well, why didn't you hire him? Why don't you give him a job, and he can show you how he did it? Why do you go try to do it on your own? And I think the reason is they're embarrassed that they can't figure it out on their own, and they want to be the ones to say to the world, we figured out anti-gravity. Now, the gentleman you're going to have on Tuesday night, Gary McKinnon, claims, and he said in the BBC interview, that he believes in the next 7 years it's going to be everywhere. Anti-gravity is going to be everywhere.
He really must have seen some things.
He must have seen some things, and I can't wait to hear, you know, what you ask him. You know, if we had anti-gravity right now, we could float an iceberg and land it in a dry lake bed and end a drought and grow a forest and produce more oxygen. We could, you know, end the droughts in Africa. We could produce lakes for them that they could use to grow food, but also to grow forests. You know, there's so many things you can do with anti-gravity. It would change real estate. It would change, you know, our architecture. We'd be building giant monolithic structures like, you know, stone masonry, like the Great Pyramids and Baalbek and all these great sites. We could be doing things like that and beyond. Building, when I looked at the castles in the movie The Lord of the Rings, I thought we could do that with anti-gravity, but we don't build things like that now because we don't have that power. So if we do have it in our military, we do have it somewhere, you know, at Lockheed or wherever, we need to be using this now. I mean, there's no reason to hold back.
Do you think, you know, that one day we'll be really with flying cars? And if we are, though, aren't we going to have some serious accidents?
Oh, you know, when I saw that Bruce Willis movie with the Fifth Element, and they were all flying in different levels.
Oh, my God.
I thought, how come they're not crashing into each other? It reminded me of India, New Delhi, where they don't even have traffic lights, and then everyone's flying through. You know, that is another problem. And, of course, when people can do light speed and beyond and they want to evade the IRS, they can just go to another planet. And how do you police a galaxy?
Well, they'll figure it out.
By the time we get to that point, we're going to have access to resources and minerals from other planets. Poverty is going to be a thing of the past. Energy is not going to be this big commodity. It's going to be a whole different universe.
What do you think of Ingo Swann's remote viewing that he put in his book, Penetration, that he believes there are alien structures on the moon?
I think there probably are, because I know that, you know, not the most advanced civilizations in the galaxy, the ones that move through the singularity, I don't even believe they use fuel, but I think the ones that are you know, traveling slower but still amazing, they need the helium-3, and the moon is, you know, all of the moons in our solar system are loaded with it.
The old movie From Earth to the Moon, yeah. Jules Verne, do you think it's very possible that an ancient mankind civilization may have already gotten to the moon maybe 100,000, 200,000 years ago?
I think it is cyclic. I think that, you know, Atlantis, in the great epochs of civilization, there we did have this kind of technology and we did destroy ourselves. Look where we are right now. I mean, we're on this beautiful planet. There's so many incredible things about the human race, and in the extras on the Dan Aykroyd DVD, this was a scene I had to delete from the main movie, but he's talking about, if you were looking at the planet Earth from the outside in, you would see the Renoir, Titian, the music, the blues, the classical music, and you would just go, there's so many beautiful things about humanity that would be interesting to explore culturally from if you were coming from another planet. But then, yet again, here we are, we're about to destroy the planet because of the fuels we use for our cars and our homes, and we have solved that already. You know, Michael Fulton and his partner, Bob Walters with Entech Solar, the breakthrough they have in solar panels, they're using it on the space station. They're using it on some of our satellites that are, you know, powering ion thruster drives. It's successful, but we're not using it in our homes yet. We have the power right now to live sustainably, and if we can do that, we will get to the space age. We'll actually get there.
My favorite quote, see if you can guess the name of this movie, okay?
Mm-hmm.
It says, "You're an interesting species, an interesting mix. You're capable of such beautiful dreams and such horrible nightmares."
Contact.
You got it. I love that.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, that was another one. And look at all the movies in Hollywood that focus on this subject in a positive way, like that movie, and how successful it was. And, you know, War of the Worlds was fun for a lot of people, comic book style, but I want Spielberg, or I don't rely on anybody. If he doesn't want to do positive ET movies and he's not really interested in the subject, then I'll do it. You know, I'll produce it.
You will get. And you live in our neck of the woods here in L.A., don't you?
Yeah, I live in Los Angeles.
Okay, well, we got to meet. How come we really haven't? You owe me lunch, or I owe you lunch.
Yeah, we do. Let's have tea.
You got that right. Hey, when we come back, let's open up the phone lines. You ready, David?
Yes, I am.
Okay, phone lines are up. Call us. We'll be back. David, when did you say your book, Singularity, will be done?
Well, I'll be finished. I'm just fine-tuning it right now this summer. So it will be done, and that will be, you know, probably one of my favorite things I've ever done.
Give us another recap on that.
Well, you know, it would take quite a while to do this, but essentially what we discover is that I always start with the Garden of Eden, the proverbial, you know, partaking mm-hmm. of the proverbial forbidden fruit of the knowledge of good and evil, that produces three types of inertia that we, the human beings, are limited by. And the first one is, of course, because the nature of good and evil is that you're ingesting conflict. And if you start with a vision of a singular universe where there is no conflict, there is just love, you know, the highest vibration in the universe, as soon as you have duality, good and evil, you now have gone from love to conflict. And conflict is a lower vibration than love, so it falls out of that heavenly state. And as we ingest it individually, 6 or 7 billion people on the planet, the problem is when we define it egotistically, what is good and what is evil, we can never agree. By nature, we end up arguing, and arguments lead to divisions, and those divisions ultimately lead to violence and war. Because one person thinks that my religion is superior than yours, or my version of my religion is better than yours, and a single religion becomes divided, you know, hundreds of times. And so we don't, you know, God doesn't really kick us out of paradise. We kick ourselves out because we actually believe that our religion or our interpretation of it is superior than the other. And that's the illusion. So the inertia we're experiencing is conflict. That's the first inertia. The second inertia is movement through the universe, which if we look at, you know, from the movie What the Bleep Do We Know, Dr. Emoto's experiments on water.
Oh, yes. We've had him on. I love him. He's a great guy.
And you can see that consciousness can affect math. It can affect biology. It can affect water. It can tell it what to do. And I really believe that collectively, because we've all partaken of this duality consciousness, we are encoding the atom with duality. When you look at atoms, which we're all comprised of, even our biological cells, they are all dual paired. There's proton, positive, electron, negative. When you zoom in on electron, you get electron, anti-electron, which is a positron. So the electron is dual paired. And then when you look at the proton, you see the proton has an antiproton. So everything is dual paired. When you go into the components of the proton, you get quarks, which are all dual paired. You have up quarks, down quarks, you know, everything is dual paired. Now, what causes inertia or resistance, the second inertia, is duality. When you try to move through space-time or the fabric of space, you encounter resistance because of those polarities. Positive and negative are attracted to each other, so they produce pressure against each other. The only thing in the physical universe we know of that is single is light. Initially, it appears to be single. Jesus said in the gospel, in Matthew, I think it's 6:22, if thine eye be single, thy whole body shall be filled with light, which means if you end the internal conflict, you essentially attain light consciousness. And in the fact that physicists have confirmed this consistently with what he's saying is that if you end the internal conflict, you attain this sort of singularity. It's further confirmed in the Gospel of Thomas where Jesus says, if thine eye be single, thy whole body shall be filled with light, but if thine eye be divided, thy whole body shall be filled with darkness. Now, in Matthew, it doesn't say divided. It says evil, which I believe is a mistake. I think that the Gospel of Thomas is even more perfect. Now, what happens is in the atom is consciousness, just like, you know, Emoto's experiments prove, we are encoding our matter on our planet, our atoms in our bodies and our, you know, the literal dual natured structure of the physical universe, and that's why we can't move faster than light. Now, light moves at 186,000 miles per second, which comes to 670 million miles per hour, and it's not fast enough. It doesn't move instantly anywhere in the universe. So even if we were doing light speed, it would take us over 2 million years to get to our closest galaxy, Andromeda. So it's all too slow. Now, what is light's duality? What is the inertia that is pressing upon the light? When physicists look at light waves, they actually spin in a positive, which means clockwise, spinning wave motion, and they don't actually have any duality inside of them. But what they move through is the fabric of space-time, which is known as Einstein's cosmological constant, which is positive but produces negative pressure. So when light moves, the negative pressure is attracted to the positive spin of light, and they push up against each other and slow each other down. Now, this is confirmed further in experiments with water. When we move, Richard Feynman did this in The Strange Theory of Light and Matter. When you move light waves through water, it actually goes slower than the speed of light because it encounters a more dense form of inertia.
Right.
Now we're moving light waves through this Einstein Bose and condensate, which is a true absolute zero, utterly free. You're basically, this condensate takes atoms and cools them down to absolute zero. So they're freezing. And when light moves through that, it encounters even more inertia, and they've got light waves moving at only several miles per hour now, which means that light can encounter more and more inertia. And most recently I heard that they've got negative light now. Light is going backwards in time now. It's moving so slow it's going the other way, which is really incredible because it shows you that light, the very presence that we use to rely on Einstein's relativity, is not really a constant, and it's not instantaneous. It's encountering inertia. So when Paul Dirac discovered in this, you know, thanks to my friend Luke Gatto, he turned me on to this paper, that, rejected by the Nobel Prize-winning physicist Paul Dirac. It was rejected by the mainstream community. He found this substratum to the universe, this sea of negative energy, which is singularly charged. It's a negative sea that spits out any positive or any dual pairs. It will not allow them in. The only way to go in is if you remain negative. Now, that's not negative spiritual energy. That's just a negative charge. But it, to me, it's not really negativity, because if it was negativity, traditionally, it would attract a positive, which would form another duality. So I have renamed it a singularity C. Now, Dirac noticed right away that if you were to enter the C as a negative, because there's no duality, there's no inertia, there's no resistance, you can move in zero time anywhere in the universe. And in fact, you're not even moving, because you're already, in a sense, omniscient, omnipresent. You're everywhere. In fact, you don't even need to move because you're everywhere. In fact, if you enter the singularity, I had this fascinating talk with my father, who's a psychologist, Lynn Sarita. You're almost proving God consciousness at that point. Like, you know, when the Buddha, prior to his full nirvana, he approaches the Bodhi tree, and I was actually there in India where this actually happened. And as he approaches the tree, there's these footprints in India where they say he stood for 3 days. Some monks say 3 months, and some say 3 years. He stood in this spot in utter amazement and you know, divinity as he was staring upon this tree. He couldn't move. And I think what happens in nirvana is this wasn't even his final nirvana. This is one of the higher stages of samadhi.
So the level.
Before
right.
his highest nirvana. But he's already everywhere in the universe, and he already is the tree. He doesn't need to take another step forward because he's already there. He's everywhere. And in that consciousness, in that singularity, there's no need to move, because in that absolute stillness, you're already the entire universe itself anyway. You're merging into supreme God consciousness. And it's so consistent what the mystics describe and what Paul Dirac describes about this sea of absolute singularity. So the question is, what this dual universe has created for us is a fabric that you cannot move through unless you solve this riddle of duality and you become one, or you enter this singularity. So I propose that only the highest UFOs, you can call them the angelic for Christians or for Buddhists. In fact, in the Hindu Bhagavad Gita, which I've read the entire thing, there are descriptions of intelligentsia who travel in craft and visit from planet to planet and, you know, dimension to dimension. And the highest planet, Krishna Loka, is where the supreme deity in Hinduism, Krishna, and his wife, Radha, reside. Now, they're moving, I believe, through the singularity because they're the only ones who can do it, because you actually have to be able to enter that consciousness to enter the singularity. Because if you remain a duality, if you remain in a state of conflict, it will spit you out. It won't allow you to enter it. So really, what we're doing here is we're scientifically proving that the mystics were all perfectly accurate about their descriptions of enlightenment and nirvana in the physics world. But it gets even more fascinating when you come to the third inertia. The third inertia is our very cells and our body. They are all comprised of atoms that are in this dual state. And in this dual state, because atoms are in duality, they are encountering inertia, resistance, and friction, which causes them to consume all of their energy, which gives birth to aging and death. So when we go back to the Garden of Eden in the book of Genesis, we find that we lost, by partaking of the knowledge of good and evil, that God predicted that we would die, and prior to that we had eternal life, so we know that we would die. But now we understand what the cause of death mm-hmm. is, which is that our cells are in a state of dis-ease or conflict. I think it was Bruce Lipton who wrote the book, The Biology of Belief, and it was Michael Fulton who lent me that book, and I read it. He proves that consciousness is actually telling our cells what to do. And it's very similar to Dr. Emoto's experiments with the water. But actual biological cells are not. He found out that the DNA and the RNA are not the brain of the cell in the center. But the membrane of the cell is the true brain of the cell on the periphery, because it's receiving instructions from consciousness, the individual. So if we are all collectively agreeing to identify with this duality, we are holding the dual universe in place. We are keeping it in this state. If we can eventually learn how to tell our not only consciousness to enter this oneness, this undivided state of love that Jesus constantly refers to in the Gospel of Thomas, that Buddha is constantly referring to in non-dualism and Buddhism, and the Hindus have the same philosophy of non-dualism. What happens is, first we get to consciously experience oneness or God consciousness, and eventually, if we tell ourselves and our body what to do to end the conflict over good and evil, to not egotistically define what is good and what is evil. In fact, in the Gospel of Philip, which in the Da Vinci Code, I think Dan Brown never mentioned this particular fragment of the Gospel of Philip. He was focused more on Mary Magdalene. Jesus says, in this world there is good and evil. Its good things are not good, and its evil things not evil. Now, of course, mystics in his day thought, oh, this is ludicrous because he's saying good isn't good and evil isn't evil. He's actually advocating evil. But really what he's doing is he's trying to dispel the illusion of good and evil both, because the whole thing is a conflict. And it's nothing but a conflict, and no matter how you define it, somebody always disagrees with you, whether it's slightly or severely. So you have these three different types of inertia. Now, my new breakthrough in the field is when I applied, in the last chapter in my book, I applied it to the Big Bang, which today, in fact, most classical physicists don't know what happened even a fraction of a second before the Big Bang. They only know that at the moment of the Big Bang, you have this enormous temperature, and the universe starts at a sub-Planck length, tiny sphere, and it explodes into the whole universe. And you have this enormous temperature at the moment of the Big Bang, and then the universe, as it expands, it's cooling off, and eventually matter coalesces, and the planets and the stars form, and eventually, human life. Well, when I applied the singularity to the Big Bang, I using Paul Dirac's discovery, you go from singularity, which is non-dualism, which is an infinitum of energy, absolute instantaneity of movement, so there really is no movement. There's no time value. Time is at zero because there's no distances that are conquered, or movement is instantaneous, so there really is no time doesn't exist. Space doesn't even exist. But as soon as you have duality, as soon as the moment the first duality forms, you have friction, because positive and negative clash against each other. That friction produces temperature, and that friction produces inertia, resistance, which means now because you have resistance, things are slowing down, and that means time is born. So as the universe is expanding, time value is increasing, and the universe merely appears to be expanding only because time is born. Prior to that, everything was an instantaneity, so that is how ultimately Paul Dirac says in his paper, you explain the even temperature of the cosmic microwave background radiation. How did it distribute itself preeminently, evenly, rather than a gradient temperature? If the universe started at a hot, infinite point of energy and then it cooled off as it expanded, you should see a gradient temperature background measurement, not an even one distributed everywhere.
I wonder how often that happened, David.
Exactly. How many universes have been created, and what kind of, wave formations and architectures are they? And that's what I think the 95% missing mass is in the universe. In fact, if we look at the number of missing, it's 95% of the universe is missing. And we only use 5% of our brains, apparently. I mean, so which means, we're only seeing 5% of the universe, and we're only using 5% of our brain's capacity. You get the same numbers. So maybe the reason we can't observe the 95% missing mass is because of the particular state of our brains. Now, as we become more enlightened, I think we're going to start to see more and more of those multi-layers to our universe. I mean, here's an amazing example of that. You have the story of Shambhala in Tibetan Buddhism. They actually have reports, and when I was in India at the Dalai Lama's in 1996, there are these great lamas who actually claim to have been to Shambhala, this interdimensional, invisible city that we can't actually see and touch, but if you go into these very purified states, you can be invited to visit this city. Just north of Dharamsala, IndiaNet Daily reported in the past 2 years, people have been seeing UFOs regularly just flying straight into this mountain and disappearing. And apparently happening a lot up there. It's possible. The Buddhists actually have a prophecy that in the end of times, their equivalent of the Antichrist is known as Rudra Chakran, who is this evil king of terror who conquers all the armies in the world. And once he's conquered everything, all of a sudden the mists clear and this city of Shambhala reveals itself to the world, and when he uses his armies to approach the city, they have the power of the mirror, which means every time we fire a missile at them, the missile turns around and comes back at us, and no one can touch them. There's UFO technology there. There's enlightened beings there, and they've always been there interdimensionally. We haven't seen it. Now, Padmasambhava the Buddha, the father of Tibetan Buddhism, originates from Afghanistan. He migrated from Afghanistan to what we now know as Tibet. And that's where he brought Buddhism into China at the time, where a religion called the Bonpo was the predominant religion. So today, in the mountains of Afghanistan, that is why the Tibetan Buddhists have those huge Buddha statues marking where they believe after he died and his female consort, Yishi Shagyal, they reside in this huge copper mountain paradise in the mountains of Afghanistan.
That's where the Taliban were destroying the statues.
Exactly.
Remember?
So, which means they have no respect for the history of the Tibetan Buddhists when they were doing that. They didn't realize that those aren't in Afghanistan for no apparent reason.
I know. They knew what they were doing, David.
They knew what they were doing.
Stay with us. Your phone calls, as promised, next when we come right back. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with David Sarita. Let's go to the phones now. East of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hey, how's it going, George?
Good, thank you.
This is Jay calling from Connecticut. I have a question for David.
Sure, Jay, go ahead.
David, this is more of a kind of a ethical question. I believe in UFOs and such. I'm not sure exactly what they are. But let's just say that we are receiving visitations. Do you feel, in your opinion, that some of them could be from our galactic neighbors who may have a keen interest in us because they look at us as a race and say, these people are growing by leaps and bounds technologically, but morally and ethically they're kind of stagnant. And they are capable of great destruction, and someday they may reach out and they may become our problem. We need to keep an eye on them.
Exactly. I think that's one of the reasons why it's so important, the way the universe protects itself with great distances between star systems, that you, if you enter the singularity, you have to get to experience that divine consciousness of love just to enter it, even in your spacecraft. And until you can reach those levels in consciousness and get beyond warfare and violence, and religious fanaticism, you know, my religion is better than yours, or my version of mine is better than yours, and bombing each other, the one God remains undivided, and the divisions are all in ignorance, and it protects itself. So that second inertia movement, if the universe protects itself in these great distances between star systems, that we won't be able to get there until we can enter these higher levels of singularity. And that means we have to evolve consciously at the same time. We have to enter those states of consciousness spiritually. And when we do, there is no violence, because when you end the conflict over good and evil internally, you're peaceful. And you're incapable of a violent episode because you're now peaceful. And in fact, as soon as you enter back into conflict, it just spits you back out. And that's what Paul Dirac found out about all dual pairs that, you know, that came out of the sea of negativity, the sea of negative energy, which is a singularity, that a positive and a negative can't exist as a pair inside of it. It spits it out. And once you're spit out back into the dual universe, you encounter inertia. And you're stuck with Einstein's law, and you can't move as fast as the speed of light, let alone faster. So I don't think they even have to worry, because the universe is protected. But our local, you know, planetary domains and possible, not great distant civilizations, they may be very concerned about us, because look at the way we treat each other, let alone our planet. And God forbid if we got this technology and we started moving around, then you do have Star Wars, you know, local galactic or planetary Star Wars.
Hey, thanks for the question. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hello.
Yeah, hi. Go ahead, sir.
Oh, hi. My name is Sal. I'm calling from Silicon, Washington, Washington
sure,
State.
Sir. Mm-hmm.
It's indeed a great honor to meet both of you gentlemen this evening.
Thank you.
I had two very good questions I wanted to ask David, and possibly a third.
Let's go with just two, because everyone's stacking up. Go ahead.
Oh, sure. I was just wondering if you thought that anti-gravity would also be very useful in producing controlled nuclear fusion.
Oh, yeah. In fact, I met Glenn Seaborg once, who was the chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission, and he said if anyone could produce a gravity generator, you would have something far beyond nuclear fusion. And he said we wouldn't even need to do that. But I think it would also, at the same time, if you wanted to create fusion reactions, I think it would. There could be a connection there, but I haven't actually, you know, thought about that. I mean, gravity is something right now that, you know, the most simple phenomena. You know, you drop a pencil and it falls to the floor. Or we're stuck on the planet. Yet we don't understand gravity really very well at all. So there, first you need to understand gravity and find the graviton and then see how it would apply to fusion.
Okay, thank you very much. The second question, I was just wondering what you thought about the Indian yogis and their ability to levitate?
Well, you know, there are stories of this, and I even saw a video of a near New Delhi in India. It's a Muslim shrine where people chant the name of this one Islamic prophet, and this giant stone levitates. I've been to India. I didn't see anybody levitate. But, yes, I mean, yoga and meditation is real. I mean, it's a real metaphysical practice that transforms consciousness. And eventually, when you are able to talk to your atoms in your body and transform them, all kinds of miracles can happen. And in fact, in the Gospel of Thomas, Jesus constantly refers to, you know, transforming the duality to the singularity. And when you attain the singularity, you can tell the mountain to move and it will move. So he's really telling you how he did his miracles. He did it by way of the singularity. And in fact, the resurrection form, which is, you know, Jesus resurrected for Christians, but there are cases in Buddhism where they have what's called the rainbow body. When a Buddhist master dies, they don't bury the body, they leave it out, and all of a sudden there's a bright rainbow of light and where the body was, and they come back and there's nothing left but the scalp and the hair. So these masters actually transform their flesh into light, which is a resurrection.
All right, Wildcard Lion, it's your turn. Hi.
Yes, my name is Dr. Jim, and I want to preface this by saying that I've not spoke about this since the year 2000, and I want to add some credibility, and this might give me away, but I believe that you guys need to hear this. I have a PhD in from the university, I'll put it this way, from Munich, and also a master's degree in mechanical engineering. I will also tell you the fact that I was employed by General Motors. I'm wondering if a guest or you have heard of a gentleman by the name of Trevor Constable.
Oh, I know Trevor well.
Yes, well, you're familiar with the Oregon Energy then?
Oh, yeah, I talk to Trevor all the time.
Well, I'm wondering if I had duplicated, and there might be something to this, and I'm wondering if you thought of this in that realm. I had duplicated his experiment for General Motors and presented it, actually, to the board of directors. On the accumulator of the Oregon Energy and also on the weather engineering portion. They were both successful. My PhD is in...
Have you talked to Trevor recently?
I don't know how to tell you this, but anyway, it was in a mathematical field, and I had a working model in the year 1999 of an engine, for lack of a better term, that used the Oregon energy as the source of its fuel, and I believe deep down that this might be what some of these UFOs are using.
Mm-hmm.
General Motors had sent me as the lead advanced vehicle development engineer of this program. And in the year 2000, once I had, it took me a few months, that's it, a mathematical model, not a physical model, but a mathematical model on paper. We have to fill out many forms for the government, of course, for a new energy source. Once those forms were submitted, it was completely shut down. They came back and shut down my program. Also, within 3 months, I was fired from General Motors. I had demonstrated again my accumulator, which actually, again, I used the board of directors at the time for such a thing as he had a sore throat and an earache, and it had cured in 30 minutes, a sore throat and earache. And I had demonstrated to him again on paper what we could do to try to come up with another, I wanted to come up with another company. I was followed, and I was shot at and one of the bullets had hit me, and I'm now paralyzed from the waist down.
Oh,
I'm very nervous of talking about this, but I would like you, David, right? Theoretical mathematics is my, from the University of Munich, is where my PhD is from.
I'll tell you what we'll do. Well, let's get his phone number, and you two can converse, okay?
As well as that other woman who called in earlier.
Yes.
I want to get her number.
I think Tom has that.
Okay. I'll call you guys tomorrow to get all that.
Okay, very good, David.
Okay.
Thanks for your call, Dr. Jim. Though I'm a little skeptical because he took a long time to remember his own PhD.
Yeah, I noticed that. He knew Trevor Constable's work. I mean, I'm always open-minded. I think the thing to do is have him talk to Trevor.
Well, that's true.
And see what Trevor...
Of course, don't all you have to do is Google search and you can find out what Trevor's been doing?
Oh, yeah. But how to get a hold of him, I think his email's online.
Let's go to our international line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Yeah, Art, this is Albert.
Well, I'm not Art, but that's okay.
Well, that's okay. It's a killer show you have tonight. Listen, last week I was setting up my telescope down here in Mexico, and one of the strangest things, so you understand, I don't disbelieve that there's UFOs until the other night. I was going to show some of the friends here the Orion Nebulae. And from the west coming to the east, there was two bright lights that came in. They came to a screeching halt, and then they just kept getting larger and larger, and they were like rainbows.
Wow.
And then they just, poof, disappeared.
They go interdimensional. That's incredible. Where did that happen?
This is down in Baja California in Mexico.
Wow.
Now, wait a minute. I'm not done yet.
Okay.
I started talking to my Mexican friends, and they told me there is a gentleman here that they will introduce me to that claims that he was one of the survivors of the Roswell crash. And I thought, I don't buy anything. You got to prove things to me before I buy into it.
Mm-hmm.
I have a son that works up in Alaska, and he's on George's favorite project, the Harp Antenna
mm-hmm.
project. And I contacted him because I used to live up there. He turned me on to a letter that was written to the commanding general of the Air Defense Command in September of 1947 because they blindfolded me, took me to the mountains, and introduced me to this gentleman. And he told me that his craft that he was in, he called it a shuttle, but it went down in Alaska. There were three of them. And they were leaving the area. They were trying to escape to get away because they were taken as prisoners. And his plane went down in Alaska. And I thought, okay, great. Well, my son turned me onto this, and I'm sitting here looking at these two letters. One was addressed to the commanding general of the Air Defense Command at Mitchell Field, New York, and it's dated September the 3rd, 1947. And the general claims in there is no such thing as flying discs. And to tell this Tech 4 Harold Johnson that the statement that he is claiming that it was given to him are misinterpretation. Well, I've talked to this guy. They took me up there, and I would like to know exactly where he's at because I want to go back up there. But unfortunately, they're very secretive with him because he helps these people in this area in ways that you can't believe.
All right, now I'm a little confused, though, when you talk about a survivor. Are you talking about an alien or a human being?
This is an alien. Well, I guess he's a human being. He is as human as you and I are.
I mean, from this planet?
No, he's from a different place.
Okay.
Now, so you understand, there's somebody that George Norrie had on his program. His name is Byron Bastillos. And he agreed to Byron to have doctors do a DNA on him and do blood samples and everything. But somehow it leaked out, and the government sent people down here to get this guy. And the natives in this area, the Mexicans in this area, took him and hid him in the mountains.
Where is that? Where he is now?
That's where he is right now. I met him just 3 days ago.
All right, and you claim this guy's an extraterrestrial?
Yes, he is. He gave me some material that he had, I'm a metallurgist. I got a master's degree in metallurgy, and I did some testing on it, and it's nothing that I know of. I don't know what it is.
So can you get us some of this stuff we can look at?
I've got this, and if I talk to them in confidentiality, they would probably blindfold me and take me back up there.
Sure.
Again.
I mean, would you?
I want to meet him again, and I want to go into more detail.
Would you share your phone number off the air with us so we can give it to David?
Okay, I have because of the Telnor phone system down here, I have a Yahoo phone number up in the United States. You call me on that number.
All right.
And bring me here.
All right. Well, you hold on, Tommy. Get him on the international line, and because he is in Mexico now. And
yeah, we have a lot of the Mexican UFOs in the Dan Aykroyd movie as
that's
well.
That's an incredible story, David.
And I'm not surprised. I mean, they don't have a big military like we do. They're right on the border. A lot of ETs may be landing there and in their mountains because they're not so invasive in their military. That's what a joke that Jaime Musan made. Why are there so many UFOs in Mexico? Because, you know, Mexicans are friendly.
What is your take on the fact that the whatever this creature may be looks just like us?
Well, I think there are more humanoids out there that are just like us. I don't think we're the only ones, but you know, I'm always suspicious, but I'm also open-minded at the same time. But you need to see proof. I'd be interested in seeing the letters first that he claimed.
Yes, me too. And I believe that if this seed that travels throughout the universe that seeds other planets, I think eventually it's going to end up looking like we do.
Sure.
I think it's the same thing.
When we attain that technology and we find planets that are, you know, could sustain human life, we'll probably leave people behind and they'll spawn new civilizations, and then, you know, we'll come back and visit them, and they'll go, oh, my God, they look just like us.
You've got a lot of numbers when you call back tomorrow. First-time caller line, you're on Coast to Coast.
Hey, gentlemen, how you doing?
Good.
I have to admit, I teared up during the first half of the show because I'm not crazy anymore.
No, you're not.
I gave my number to Tom, David. It is imperative that you call me tomorrow. This actually is serious. I believe I can get you very good footage, probably the best footage you've had of a triangle so far.
Really?
And I'll explain. In the year 2001, from about October till about June of 2002, I traveled 66,000 miles that year. Just I had a lot going on, a lot of traveling. Took a lot of weird routes, just to kill the boredom.
Mm-hmm.
I was in a particular location one night. My girlfriend at the time was with me, and she says, look at that up in the sky. And there were some balls that were kind of moving around. And I said, oh, those are just choppers, by the way they're moving. There's no way they can be a plane. My dad was in the Air Force. I grew up around Wright Pat, around a lot of aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like, oh, well, those are choppers. You know, a plane can't move like that. Now, we're in the middle of the desert, and I mean, I'm talking the desert where it's, you know, 30 degrees below, probably, because ice was forming on the front of the car, what have you. So, anyway, these things started moving around. I'm like, this doesn't look right, and so I finally saw the triangle, although at the time I didn't know that, you know, was what it was. It was far off.
Daytime or nighttime?
This was nighttime. Now, it had the light pattern. See, the thing is, I didn't tell anybody about this for years, and then finally, you know, I heard about Art Bell finally seeing. I called Art 2 days after, you know, and he said, oh, yeah, whatever. And then, you know, lo and behold, he sees one, you know, a year or so later. And so I pulled over at this point. It kept getting closer and closer, and the balls were basically dancing around this thing. And the closer it got, I realized that it was a triangle, and I saw the light pattern on the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
This thing was, I'm telling you, the reason I pulled over, first of all, is I, you know, noticed there was no signature, there was no sound.
Wow.
And at that point, I was like, okay, something's not right here. This is not a jet.
David, do you think that these are government or extraterrestrial, these big triangles?
The big triangles.
And we got 30
I mean,
seconds
the
left, David.
One, like in the Phoenix Lights, there's no way that's ours. But I'd like to see his video because, you know, I'm looking for some good night footage that you can see the actual structure, the outline, like that one photo that I mentioned.
Well, we've got four or five phone calls for you to make tomorrow.
Yeah, I know. I'll make them. I may not make them tomorrow, but I'll make them in the next week or two.
Okay, Tom will get them all. David, once again, where do you get the video, Dan Aykroyd Unplugged on UFOs?
You can get it on Amazon right now. You can get it probably at Best Buy. See the trailer at daufo.com or go to your store and tell them to get it.
Very good. Thanks a lot, David.
Thank you, George.
Appreciate you being on Coast to Coast. For Karis Coburn, Steve Carr, Dan Galanti, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, Ross Mitchell, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. I'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.